What are you eating over there? Directly into the microphone.
What is it?
This is like Fisherman's Friend.
Should be illegal, man.
We're live. All right. Fisherman's Friend. That's like a gross cough drop, right?
But you don't feel like doing when I lecture a lot and you have to speak in a loud voice for a long time. Sometimes my throat is killing me. I take one of these things. I don't fucking feel anything for 20 minutes. It's like anesthesia or something. It's insane.
Interesting. I'll have to look into it. But they taste like shit, right?
Yeah, but it's so bad that it's beyond tasting good or bad. It's like
right.
It's a whole
like a medicine type thing.
It's something else.
This episode of the Joe Rogan Experience podcast is brought to you by Carbonite. Carbonite is a backup option where you can back up all your data and information online. Small businesses, regular folks like you or I that have a lot of shit that you're trying to back up. It's really simple. Proposals, contracts, invoices, contact lists, all essential stuff for running your businesses. Uploading it online is a nice, safe, easy way to make sure it's always there. Carbonite is available for all computers. It works on everything. And when you have Carbonite, you'll never have to worry about losing your computer files, no matter how many computers your business has or where they're located. Carbonite backs up your files to the cloud securely, automatically, and continually, which is a very nice thing. If you're a guy like me that's always like, yeah, I got to remember to back that up. I don't back shit up. I think I'm going to back it up. I know I'm going to back it up, and it never gets done. But this way, it does it easily. It does it automatically, and you don't have to think too much about it. It keeps your files safe without any hassle for you or your employees, and it's affordable. We use Carbonite here on the podcast, and you could try it too. Use the offer code JRE for a free trial, no credit card required, plus two free bonus months with your subscription. So that's Carbonite.com, and the offer code is JRE. Go to Carbonite.com and get your freak on. Back your shit up, son. Take it seriously, okay? Please. We're also brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com is a nice, easy way for you to send things through the mail without having to go to the post office and weigh shit. You weigh it at home. They provide you the digital scale. You enter in the information on your computer, print up the actual postage on a printer, slap it on the box, and it's gone. As soon as the mailman comes, hand it to him. You don't have to deal with any of the nonsense of going to an actual post office, getting in the actual line, and dealing with an actual employee that doesn't actually give a fuck what you're sending. It doesn't really want to talk to you, and you're being annoying, man. If I was working at the post office and this asshole came in with 36 boxes of different sizes, I'd be like, oh no, how boring. But this way you can do it all at home. And with this no risk trial, use the promo code JRE. You get a $110 bonus offer, which includes the digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. All of it, again, can be done through your home computer. You just hand the boxes to the postman when he comes, and you're diggity, diggity done. That's it. You don't have to deal with any more nonsense. So use the code word JRE. Click on the microphone, the old-schooly microphone in the upper right-hand corner, and enter in that code for your $110 special bonus offer. We're also brought to you by Onnit. That's Onnit.com. Onnit. And we just started carrying these new zombie bells. These are the latest and greatest of the Primal Bell type series. We started with the ones that were just apes, with gorillas and chimps and orangutans, now howler monkeys. But now we've expanded into the supernatural, and we have actual zombie artwork that was created by the same guy who did the chimps. His name is Steven Shubin Jr., very talented artist. And he created the gorilla, the chimps, and the monkeys, and all these pretty badass zombies. So if you're like me and you're obsessed with The Walking Dead, these are an excellent way to get your workout on and have a little fun with it while you're at it. They're all 3D balanced, so they're all weighted and balanced perfectly for exercise, not just for looks. We made sure that they're designed sort of meshed well with the actual idea of using them. I mean, it's cool that they look cool and everything like that, but you really want to be able to work out with them. So you can work out with them just as easy as you can with a regular kettlebell. We also sell battle ropes, weight vests, steel maces, lots of supplements. We got all sorts of new shit that's just come in, including digestive enzymes and Onnit 180. Onnit 180 is the idea is that when you travel or when you go out and get your drink on, it's nice to have something that can replenish all the nutrients in your body in one little step. Just zip one of these little packets and toss it into a glass of water. It has a lot of different things. It combines the neurotransmitter support of Alpha Brain, the best adaptogens from Shroom Tech Sport, some 5-HTP from New Mood, and some minerals for the immune system. And these nutrients play a key role in supporting multiple body systems for recovery from stress. Like a lot of what if you get hungover or if you fly, that terrible feeling that you have, a lot of that is just being dehydrated. A lot of that is just lacking water and nutrients. And something like 180 can really help you recover from that shit, son. Use the code word JRE. No, Rogan. God, I need one code. I need one code for everything. I'm trying to fuck every commercial up on purpose just so they eventually you're forced to give me one code. Use the code word Rogan and save 10% off any and all supplements. Boom. Shalock, lock, boom. Daniele Bolelli and Dan Carlin are here, ladies and gentlemen. This shit could get epic.
Joe Rogan Podcast. Check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
If I had a thing. Of the two guys that have freaked me out the most with stories of the past, it's you two gentlemen.
It's what we do.
It's a pleasure.
For out of all the years of listening to podcasts and talking to you guys on the podcast, you are, without a doubt, the two men who have freaked me out the most. You, with that crazy story about the bodies on the stakes, was it in Persia or Rome? What was the story?
The guys, I think I told you two. One about, of course, impaling and all the fun stuff that goes with it. And the other one was about the end of Spartacus Rebellion, where they crucify some 5,000 people on the road between Naples and Rome.
That was it. Yeah.
That's
dark.
That would be a trip that you probably remember if you take the road on those days.
Could you even imagine? The idea. I mean, how many miles is that? What is 5,000 people? How far do they space them out?
Is it about 100 miles, something like that?
Jesus
Rome to Naples.
Jesus fucking Christ.
Something like
100
that.
100 miles of crucified bodies.
Every so many steps, one more.
And then another one. You know, what is that, a blink in terms of actual time on this planet? Just a blink
right.
ago. Like these same things that we go to school with and go to the supermarket with, these same humans are capable of that in their darkest of dark days. From your podcast and from Daniele's, I think the understanding of how easy we got it is really cemented home. You know, your stories, some of the stories, like especially one of the ones that I really enjoyed recently is the Martin Luther tale, the tale of Lutheranism and the Anabaptists.
Oh,
and
in the city of Munster and all that.
Yeah. Fascinating.
It's Waco on a huge scale.
Yeah. fascinating stuff. And again, not that long ago, man. 1500 something? What was it?
Oh, a guy like that could arise today, too. I mean, they still make those kind of people.
Yeah. Yeah, they do. What is it about people that fall for that shit? I mean, it's just...
There's a sucker born every minute, right?
But why? What is the flaw in humans that we're willing to believe people that are that fucking nutso?
My take is the appeal of authority. That's why the Hitlers of the world gain an audience, is because most people are insecure. Most people like a father figure to tell them, I got it under control. I'm the strong man in charge. I can take care of business. Look at me. And I think there's an appeal of people who have daddy issues. They like dictators. You know, and that's probably slightly oversimplifying, but I think there's a part of it.
There's also a thing where I think people really terribly want to be a part of a group.
Oh, yeah.
Like very, very much so. And the more extreme their devotion to that group is, sometimes the more rewarding the actual experience of being in the group is. It means something special to be a part of this wacky group of crazy fucks that's willing to murder people. Like it's almost like this extra charge of being alive that's missing from a lot of people's lives. I think that being involved in a cult or, you know, any sort of crazy, wild, rebellious group that's doing dangerous things, it's like it's almost to fill a void that's left in human beings, that we've sort of like these echoes of our primal days that are still just lingering around in our DNA, looking to be played upon with the right harp note. You know?
I think there's almost, too, when you think about like a Hitler, there's some wonderful film you can see of Hitler with crowds on the street, and you can see the look in the people's eyes, and they look like they're seeing a movie star and they just want to get a little touch. Maybe my hand will touch his fingers. And you think to yourself, Hitler as a celebrity type figure, but there's that same thing about about because you're famous, because I don't even know how, I've never understood the celebrity thing where people just get dumb around, but it's the same sort of the look in the eyes, and it's like seeing Elvis, and instead it's Hitler.
Yeah, I think you're onto something there for sure, because there's something about the ultimate celebrity experience, like meeting a guy like Obama or meeting a guy, you know, any world leader type character. It would be so overwhelming. Just the presence of that person. Now think about this all happening at a time when, you know, it's fucking really hard to get a book.
Right.
You know, really hard to be properly educated and no alternative media sources that we face today. You know, goof on alternative media all you want online, and some of it is much deserved. But the one thing these guys do is they'll cover all kinds of fringe shit. Yeah. And that'll be their headline news. You know, like I go to Salon and people accuse Salon of being like too left wing and too, you know, but there's some smart people that are pushing it that way. What I like what they're doing is that their front news is like, it's not like the front news that you're going to get on CNN. It's front news about, you know, like gay and lesbian rights and things in the workplace and, you know, what politicians said about, you know, what race that was deplorable. And all that stuff's like front row shit.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really, really lefty. Very, very lefty. But that's important too. Like, that's important to have like a balance out, a super ultra sensitive to balance out the fucking savages of the 1500s that are still rolling around in our DNA. You know, you need someone out there on the fringes of super sensitive progressive behavior just to try to like give us a better medium. Give us a better baseline.
Well, let me bring it back to that Munster podcast we talked about. One of the sub-themes in that was whether or not – you remember the whole question about whether or not regular people should be able to read the Bible for themselves. And this goes to what you said about Salon or all these alternative media sites, because the Prime Minister in Great Britain over all these Snowden leaks and what The Guardian has done was talking about, you know, maybe we should dial this back. Maybe it's time for some press restrictions. In other words, maybe this is too darn dangerous that you're getting to read all this stuff and we don't have a choke point to shut it down, because in the regular media, whether it was ABC, CBS, NBC, The Washington Post, there are choke points where, you know, these people literally just pick up the red phone to the editor of The Washington Post and say, let's talk about this story you're thinking about running. That's a great choke point. When you have the media as diversified as it is now, all those choke points go away, and the David Camerons and all these people miss the choke points.
And there's people like Glenn Greenwald or Edward Snowden in a lesser extent, because he's on the run and hiding, that become huge celebrities because of information that they release to people. Like Greenwald, even though I know they harass him and they've harassed his boyfriend, they detained his boyfriend in England, but the bottom line is that guy became super famous because of this. So it's a positive thing.
Well, think of how he changed the world. I mean, I had a lot of people right when the story broke say, this is no big deal, nothing we haven't heard of, all this kind of stuff. They're not saying that now. Even John Kerry, the president, all these people have come out and said things that, oh, maybe we shouldn't be doing this. Maybe we should be having this discussion. It's really changed the world. All this stuff we're talking about now with the NSA, that's all Edward Snowden stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing that one guy can have that kind of impact. And in the future, when they look back on today, and I think historically, he's getting swept under the rug, and what he's done and the impact of it is just sort of getting ignored by the media. And more, they paint him as this controversial figure. You know, more and more, they paint him as this guy on the run from the NSA. But there's no support of him, like, in anything mainstream.
Right.
There's no support of what he did or who he is, there's no call to action for the government to release this guy, that he's actually a patriot, that he's actually looking out for the true American way and is exposing people to people, not the America, but people in America that are making a huge mistake, and they're doing it for the name of America. And whether or not they think it's right or wrong, ultimately we don't think it's right. And ultimately finding out about it pissed the entire world off.
Right.
That's the facts. So if the government was really representing the people, they would look at it in terms of like, what do all the intelligent people who've reviewed this think? Yeah, it's a travesty. It's a fuck up. It's anti-American. The idea of it is ridiculous. And the idea this is the only way you can control security is by spying on every fucking person. Well, then the terrorists have won. Right. I mean, that's a victory, because that's terror for everybody. That's no privacy. That's weirdness. That's employees like Snowden, who they kept going on and on about how he failed high school. High school dropout. High school dropout that could read my email, man.
Yeah.
High school dropout.
Yeah, that just makes you look worse. You gave the passcode to that high school dropout?
What the fuck? Why are you goofing on him? You hired him. You know, it's ridiculous. You fucking hired that guy to watch everybody's
email.
But
think of how, you know, you were talking about one person, just one guy, but think about how much that same attitude scares the government. One of their many, many, many thousands of workers was able to do that.
Yeah.
That's scary on the whole opposite side. You know what it is, too? I think we're dealing with a bit of a, and this is kind of gets them a little off the hook. I think you have a bubble mentality in all, I mean, in life. You have them in professions. I mean, scientists get it, unions get it, bureaucracies get it, the army gets it, the police gets it, where people get promoted. These guys all get promoted to the top NSA positions because they're better at spying. They figure out better ways to get around defenses and all that. They don't get promoted to that special room where there's five or six of them making policy because they did a better job of finding a Fourth Amendment that doesn't let them spy.
Yeah.
So when they're in the room, they all see the world the same way. So you tend, and this happens, like I said, in every profession, they tend to push each other forward because there's no devil's advocate there saying, wait a minute, maybe we shouldn't use every power we have to spy as much as we can. To those people, you see these NSA guys testifying in front of Congress, and they don't even hide how mad they are at us, how mad they are that this is even known, how mad that they have to be there, how mad you're questioning them. And it's because there's nobody in the room saying, guys, we shouldn't do this. And really, to be honest, there's no obvious line where you should call the dogs off, you know, where you should say, hey, maybe this is okay, but that's not okay. That does not happen. They talk about the Fourth Amendment, but then the other guy goes, well, we're not really violating the Fourth Amendment if we just take everybody's trash cans and we keep it in a storage locker with their name on it. We're only violating it if we actually, like, search through their trash, which we'll do later if we have to. And then everything's on the kosher up and up. If J. Edgar Hoover wants to search Joe Rogan's trash for evidence of illegal activity, you're going to have to send a physical agent out there to do that. Now we just collect the trash on trash day, bring it to the NSA headquarters, dump it in there, and we'll sift through it later if we have to.
Yeah, they could essentially tune in on anybody, anywhere in the world now.
With a flip of a switch.
Yeah, you know? And that kind of power is awesome if you guys are like super enlightened monks that are designed to save the world.
But the U.S. government. Right, exactly.
But if you're a regular person, you can't have that kind of juice. Regular person just can't have autonomy over all these people's information.
What if Richard Nixon had it? That's what I always say.
Oh, God.
And you think you're not going to get another one of those?
Dude, what if Dick Cheney had it?
He did have it.
Did he have it?
Yeah.
You think so?
Absolutely. He put it into place, man.
So they were accessing everybody's emails as far back as...
Yeah, this all goes... Yeah, and there's a book called The 1% Doctrine where they talk about how after the 9/11 attacks, the rule that they decided, and mainly because of Dick Cheney, to operate under was, if there's even a 1% chance of another 9/11 happening, anything is fair. You can do anything to justify it. And I think what their attitude was is on, you know, 9/12/2002, everybody would have said, oh, yeah, okay, whatever it takes, man. Yeah. Don't let that happen again, when it was still fresh in our minds.
Right. Yeah, there was a weird moment after 9/11 where I remember driving to school, or to work, rather, and driving to school. As I was driving to work, it was early in the morning, and all the commuters were going, and everybody had a flag on their car.
Yeah,
everybody had it, and it was weird. It was a weird feeling. It wasn't just a.
Yeah.
It was like everybody was reminding everybody.
How long did that last, too? Because I'm thinking, I just said 2002, and everybody's going to go, Dan, don't you know the 9/11 attacks happened in 2001? But a year later, that was still an open wound. And so when do you think, if you had to guess, when did it start to wear off and we started to normalize? I mean, New York City is exempt because I don't think they ever renormalized. But for the rest of the country, how long do you think it took to get over that PTSD?
I think it took a few years.
Yeah.
Two or three years, something like that.
I give even more.
Yeah.
Give, like, Bush second. Because, I mean, Bush being reelected made no fucking sense under any point of view other than part of the 9/11 boost that he got for a while.
Well, it was also the real problem with the voting machines. There's
right.
The real
that
openly
yeah.
reported problem right. with those Diebold machines. And
how about the candidate he ran against? That's always the first thing I look
that's
at.
That's also
too.
A good point. Yes.
I mean, if you're running against John F. Kennedy, you lose that election, but you're not. You're running against a guy, you just go, oh, really? that's my option, and right. that's what kills you.
Yeah.
Well, and a lot of people felt like the Al Gore election that got Bush into office in the first
place
was
a weird
tainted.
One. Yeah, that was a weird one.
There's so much fuckery involved in voting, man, like real open fuckery that should be like, mm-hmm. really, it's treason. Yeah. It's treasonous behavior. Mm-hmm. And these people openly do it in order to help their candidates win. I mean, it's one of the most un-American things of all time, manipulating the vote like that.
Yeah. I think somebody who was a political operative would say to you that it's one of the most American things of all time, because it's been going on. I mean, you know, George Washington's giving hard cider to people, you know, when they come to his little parties to get. I mean, this is
right.
The problem is that I and we've talked about this before. I think there's a certain amount of this that a healthy society and a healthy political system can suck up and still be okay. There's a certain tipping point where you're not that healthy anymore, and what was okay before is not suck upable anymore.
Suck upable. I love that. That's...
Well, it also begs the question. All of this stuff begs the question. Like, first of all, everyone's favorite argument is, if you have nothing to hide, then what are you worried about? And it's not that.
Right.
What it is, first of all, why do you need so much information? And what have you done that has made so many people so angry that you have to check everyone's email? Like, what is the actual cause of all this that never gets addressed? Like, whenever we're talking about how this group hates us, or that group hates us, or this group is playing, why?
Right.
Why? What did we? What
well,
did
I want to take. I want to go with
we do.
I want to go with what you said, though. If you have nothing to hide, because I was trying to get a show out before I came here, and I failed miserably. But one of the things I was going to talk about. Did you see that story? The lawsuit filed from that incident in New Mexico with the driver who didn't do the full stop at leaving Walmart. You saw it, right? Right. So the police pull him over for California stopping the stop sign, decide that he looks like he's clenching his buttocks in a weird way, and this is the part I love, goes to a judge and says to the judge, while this guy's sitting on the side of the road, he's clenching his buttocks in a weird way, I think we have somebody trying to hide drugs in there, and the judge goes, I guess, judging from the story, yeah, that would be probable cause. So they take this guy to a doctor who refuses to do what the police officers are asking. So they got to go to another doctor. 14 hours of anal cavity searches, enemas. They sedated him and did a colonoscopy. They examined his stuff right in front of him. 14 hours, found nothing, x-rayed him multiple times, found nothing, and then apparently sent him a $6,000 bill for the procedure. So when you say, what have you got to hide? Unless you're hiding, that's what can happen to you. And not just that. What I love is the police department spokesman said, we didn't do anything wrong. This is policy, and we had a judge sign off on it. So when you say if you have nothing to hide, what do you care? This guy had nothing to hide, and that happened to him.
He clearly did, because he was clenching his butt in a weird way.
You know? I know, but now if that story is true, and the lawsuit claims witnesses and all this kind of stuff, and the police officers think nothing was wrong there, that's what happens to you when you get rid of these protections that keep you from being searched willy-nilly or anything like that.
Shit, after a story like that, everyone in the world who's going to be stopped by the police is going to clench his butt in a weird way. It's just the fear of this story. It's like, right. Oh shit,
or
not the colonoscopy. No.
You're going to get people that are butt freaks, and that's what they're into. They're into cops checking them out. They're going to hide treasures up there, put secrets up there.
I didn't mean to take the conversation in that direction.
Nothing
that's
wrong
a beautiful
with it.
Direction.
It's a great direction. It's hilarious. It's fucked up that if you search someone's ass for 14 hours and there's nothing up there, that guy should be able to search yours for 28. That should be the rule. He should be able to throw firecrackers in there. And I mean, come on, man. You checked his ass for no reason. Like, you owe him something.
What bothers me about that is that there's no penalty that actually affects the people who did this. In
right.
other words, if this guy wins his big lawsuit against him, that's the taxpayers who are going to pay that. The people who did it don't suffer at all.
Yeah, like someone falsely accusing someone of murder or theft or so, you know, any crime like that, it almost should be worth just as much. If you mm-hmm. know, if you set a guy up for murder and you know he didn't really do it, it should be worth almost as much as like murdering somebody.
They're talking about that with these podcast troll lawsuits and everything to change the law that they're working on in D.C. would do some of that, would put like some of the onus on these people who say these things. And mm-hmm. if you lose your case, all of a sudden you're the one responsible for the day. In other words, something
for folks
to
who don't know
dissuade
that story.
Them. Yeah, tell that story.
I don't know the full extent of it. From what I understand, someone out there has a patent.
Says they have a patent.
Says they have a patent on I'm going to very, very broadly paraphrase this. I think it was putting something up in serial form on the internet. So essentially, it'd be like every podcast, every YouTube channel, everything.
I mean, invented that.
Yeah.
You owe us money.
The idea is ridiculous. Like, if you have the Bolelli blog and you decide to number them, you're violating a patent. Obviously, I might be way off with this. But he sent some, or the company had already won. They had beaten
on a different Apple. thing. Yeah.
On Apple, on another patent-style lawsuit, which may or may not have been more worthy. But this one is strange because he's targeting podcasters. Mm-hmm. And so it's a big
The whole goal is to get you to – it's the old shakedown, though, where they essentially say, we're not going to get – you stole our technology, but it's fine. Just give us $1,000 a month and nobody gets hurt.
Is it really that much?
Oh, I'm sure it's more. Oh, I bet it's – talk to your friend Adam Carolla. He got a letter.
Yeah. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, the idea that you could patent putting things up in serialized form on the internet. It's like
in 1994 or something, or whenever they claim to have it done.
It's what people have always done. I mean, we put everything up in serialized form. Can you imagine if someone allowed them to do that with television shows? You could never number episodes anymore. It's the stupidest idea of all time. Like, the idea that you could control that.
But see, but it's not stupid if you're them and the lawyers and everything, because that thing that they're working on in DC isn't there yet. You take a shot.
Right.
You know, you take a shot and you see what happens. There's no downside.
Yeah, I could see that. I could see it from their point of view, from strictly business sense. They'd be like, look, we're playing within the rules. These are the rules, and this is how you get paid.
Right. Yeah.
But I think that, you know, ultimately, we're going to have to agree on something that makes a lot more sense. Because, you know, you can't get money for nothing from people, and that's money for nothing. You're not contributing anything.
I think you can get money for nothing for people. I think we do that all the time.
We shouldn't.
That's
be.
The American
when
way, damn
you
it.
You can't get money for nothing. I'm talking about the ideal scenario.
Okay. Let's make that clear.
Let's make that clear. Obviously, people get something for nothing, right? I mean, I think we're going to have a real problem in this country no matter what, as long as our financial systems remain so vague and it fluctuates, goes up and down. Today, the Dow crashed. Tomorrow, the Dow rises. Like, as long as that's a possibility, like, how could you ever have anything stable ever when your entire foundation of your economy is by nature fluctuating daily? By nature, up and down, so much so that you have to close business at a certain time. Stop fucking trading! You have to blow a whistle off and say, no more decisions! You gotta stop. We have to control this economy. We have to allow chaos only in 8-hour bursts. And when those bursts are over, we have to literally shut it down.
Can you imagine how many trades there would be the second the market opens, when they've had a whole night to digest stuff? Okay, first thing in the morning, it's billions of dollars. We got to get this trade in before, because everybody will beat us to it. Can you imagine what the market would do, you know, on opening? Now, in the old days, that's how it was. But now, with the digital trading all in one second, there'd be 10 bazillion trades in a second and a half.
What's a strange idea? The idea that you could only make transactions during a very specific
especially time. In a global economy when the people in Japan are going, so we can only trade on American things when we're asleep at night? I don't understand.
Yeah, it's stupid. But if they went 24 hours, people would just take fucking Adderall and just hit it hard. Yeah,
people be dying of lack of sleep. That's right.
Way more than StarCraft. All those people that are dying from playing StarCraft, that's not even for real money.
Right.
You know, you play the economy, you're playing it for real money. Yeah. But what do you do? Like, can you day trade in the middle of the night, or do you have to do it during stock market hours?
Well, I think it's just stock.
I think you can set up trades to be enacted at the market open or whatnot.
But you can't just ride the wave and go up and down, sell and buy.
I don't think so.
Unless you're doing it maybe on Tokyo time. Maybe you could do the Tokyo Stock Exchange. They have a different stock exchange.
That's when you're a real addict, when you go, oh, man, the U.S. market closed. Where can I play? Tokyo's just coming alive.
Yeah, it is like an addiction. I really, truly believe it. I don't think it's possible that it couldn't be when you're gambling and essentially the stock market is a lot of gambling.
Yeah.
You know,
especially the way some of these people play it. It's one thing to say, I'm going to buy Coca-Cola and sell it in 25 years. It's another thing when you're going to buy Coca-Cola and sell it in 20 seconds.
Yep. And even if you're right, like if you say, no, look, it seems like a gamble to you because you're uneducated, but I, in fact, am very educated on this, and it's more of a calculated risk, but the reward to risk ratio is very high.
A lot of variables.
Yeah, but they can
show
you. That's
what every gambler always says.
But they can show you on paper, we've profited, X amount of years. interviews right. in a row. This is not nearly as unstable as you like to think it is. But part of the charge is the fact that it is a little.
Right.
So 2008 happens every now and then
yep.
where fucking everybody's scrambling and no one's got a chair and the music just shut off.
Mm-hmm. What I love about that is when they show you, you go to the financial advisor's office and they always show you the historical, the way these things are performed historically. And it's always, the graph starts right after the last terrible crash.
Right.
Yeah. And you just go, well, what about the depression? Well, the depression was an unusual situation. That'll never happen again. And I think today they must start it from like last week, don't you think? Like, yeah. like here's your historical performance in the last 7-day period.
Yeah, we don't know. You know, it's. I think the idea of trying to control an entire global economy like that is preposterous. It just doesn't make any sense. I don't understand it at all. And the people that understand it have tried to comfort me and assure me that it does, in fact, make good sense.
Right, and if that's not scary enough, then you get the collusion of government and the weird economy where, I mean, when you think about the fact that there are no laws against the fact that if you have worked for some companies, you can pick up a government job overseeing the workings of those very companies or vice versa. You are in government first, and the second you are done, you can pick up your vice president position in one of the companies that you just finished benefiting.
Yeah.
That's beyond perverted.
It's so transparent. Like,
one of the ways that they said our society could go down, though, and other societies have throughout history, is that sometimes they just get too complex to manage. Mm. And you can ride that wave sometimes until something bad happens. But a perfect example is, I mean, a lot of people said that the Great Depression happened because what was going on in the financial system overwhelmed people's ability to understand and react and compensate for things. And I remember people saying, well, we'll never have another Great Depression because we're so on top of things now. Yeah, but we have new variables that we don't understand that somebody in the future is going to say they were such idiots. It's way back there in the early 21st century.
Well, me as a barely educated fool, when I look at exactly how everything has fluctuated and the crash in 2008 and all mm-hmm. these, it makes zero sense.
Yep.
Because as a fool, I look at it and I go, look at this. There's the same amount of people. There's the same amount of metal. There's the same amount of concrete. The same amount of plastic. Same amount of material things. No one has produced or taken away anything from the pile of humanity's creations. And yet, all of a sudden, everyone's broke. Like, all of a sudden, everything fell apart. And people who were prospering just a week ago are no longer prospering. When I look at something like that, I have to feel like, okay, these guys are obviously far smarter than I, and they're running the system. So either it's rigged as fuck, and right. someone just extracted a shitload of money out of the system and did it under the guise mm-hmm. of a crash, or people are way fucking dumber than I give them credit.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those two things. And I feel like when a guy like that cat from New York that ripped everybody off in the Ponzi scheme, dude, what is his name?
Bernie Madoff.
When a cat like Bernie Madoff comes along and robs so many people, I have to go, wait a minute. So no one knows how this thing works?
Well, but I mean, look, I mean, it's not that hard to understand when people are playing with things that aren't real, but selling it for real money. And then you're counting that as something that you
right.
own. For example, we take these toxic assets, right? It's not as hard to understand as people suggest, because let's say I put you in a house you can't afford and all the evidence shows you can't afford it. And I wouldn't have given it to you 20 years ago. And then I take a bunch of people like you and I take all of your bad things that you're never going to be paying back and I bundle it into something. And then I sell that to someone else based on the value that isn't really there, because none of you can really pay it back. And then you say, well, I'm worth this much money. I own these assets and they're worth this much money. And then those assets collapse. And all of a sudden you looked like you had $50 million in your asset tree of stuff. And all of a sudden you don't. You bought something that was worth nothing. And so all that money that you had on paper just disappeared overnight because it wasn't real to begin with.
And weren't there banks during this crisis that were actually banking on things falling apart?
Hoping that they would. Hedging, exactly.
Profiting off of it falling apart.
It's supposed to be a risk management diversification tool.
Jesus Christ, that's a great way of saying what fucking
exactly. Risk management. I'm just using the proper terminology
there. I gotta write that down because that's a brilliant way of fucking someone in the ass. This is a risk management.
not a risk management for you, a risk management for them.
Right. How do they describe risk management?
Diversification tool.
That is goddamn hilarious.
The cops in New Mexico said that to the guy.
That's right. Searching your cavity is a risk management. Diversification.
I'm actually writing that down because it's so beautiful.
I think you should use that for all kinds of. Use it in the MMA color commentary. him throwing that punch that way is a risk management diversification tool.
If anybody hears that, though, if I pretended that I actually came up with that on my own, I would get shit.
All the financial advisors who watch the MMA would be going, "Now he's talking."
If I'm saying it now, I have to say it as an inside joke.
Yeah.
Wink, wink.
Risk management diversification tool. That's how we're fucking you.
Beautiful.
That's hilarious. That's a brilliant way of putting
it. I'm out. Then I'm out.
But just the idea that that could be legal, that you could be loaning people money, mm-hmm. setting up loans, and also gambling on the fact that you'll profit if they default on those loans.
Look, we know you can't afford this mortgage, but don't worry. If you can't pay it, you'll be taken out of your house, and we'll win on this other side over here.
That's my point as like an uneducated fool. When I look at that system, I go, well, obviously they set it up so they can extract money. That's the only way it makes sense. If you have the same amount of people, you have the same amount of knowledge, you have the same amount of items, and yet, all of a sudden, everything fell apart. Somebody fucked you, okay? They just did it in a way that's legal.
No, but I mean, banks, I have to tell you a story because this is too crazy. I remember when I went from two incomes to one after my wife died and everything, and so I applied for the, I forgot how they call it, loan modification, right? It's like, oh, conditions have changed. You can modify the loan to help somebody stay in the house, all that, right? So I get two letters from the bank in the same day. One, I open and it say, we can't give you the loan modification because you make too much money. You're doing too well. You don't need it. I open the next letter. It say, we can't give you a loan modification because there's no hope you can keep the house. You make too little money. There's just no way. And I'm like, what the fuck? Did you talk to each other at least? It's like, you're the same department. You're sending me, really? This is what it's about?
They just have, I bet, probably like patent excuses, especially when they feel like you're probably going to lose the house. They're like, good, we'll just snatch up his house.
This is where it gets better. I knew somebody who was hooked up with the people who owned the loan. So through somebody who knows somebody who knows somebody, we got to the president of the company, like, hey man, can you do something? Is it something that we can work with and stuff? I kid you not, the guy sent back the word, give me $20,000 under the table and I can make it happen.
Oh
no,
my
problem.
God. He asked for a bribe?
Yeah.
That
holy open.
Shit.
And if he's doing that with me, I'm imagining that's probably regular business.
That's
right?
Amazing.
But you know, there's no paper trail, so you know, you can prove it.
So you'd have to come up with 20 cash?
Yep.
$20,000 in cash. Holy shit, that's a lot of money.
But he's like, look how much you're going to save over the next 30 years. It's worth it, you know. And
that's hilarious.
I always think, to me, it's like it's when you talk about, you know, them betting both sides of the fence, essentially. How is that different, though, from a lot of us probably know some pretty darn serious gamblers.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them set their sports bets up that way, where,
yep.
where listen, if this happens, I win. And if that happens, I win, too. And either way, I'm covered. And that's definitely how the house handles things. You
yes.
know, and so that essentially, when we talk about the financial insiders in the economic realm, that's the house.
Mm-hmm.
So the house usually wins.
Yeah, and it's not a fair game. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always say I love casinos. I love going to Vegas. I love doing fights there. But if you're smart, you look around, you realize, how do you think they built this giant fucking
That's
thing?
Right. That's right.
They didn't build it on you cracking blackjack right. every week. You know, they built it on people losing money here, man. That's what
they don't
good
offer
at.
You those free trips and the free hotel rooms yeah. to come gamble because they're losing money on that.
Yeah,
deal.
They're so slick that if you win a ton of money, they'll give you free tickets.
Mm-hmm.
If you bet a ton of money and win a ton of money, they'll fly you back.
Yep.
They're like, it's just a matter of time, bitch. We got you here. Just a matter of time. It's like having a fight with Cain Velasquez. Right. If you don't knock him out, you're going to run out of gas before mm-hmm. he does. There's no doubt. It's just a matter of time. He's going to get you. If there was 25-round fights, Cain Velasquez would never fucking lose.
Yeah.
It's impossible for him to lose. He just doesn't have his gas tank is like three times larger than a normal human being's. That's the fucking house. The house can't lose, bitch. They got billions. But they do, like, my friend Dana White is he's a crazy degenerative gambler. And he gambles millions. He's lost $1 million in a night. He's made as much as $6 million in a night, I think he said,
Jesus.
On the podcast. Yeah, he's crazy. He's crazy. But he's a very wealthy man. He was at the Palms, and he whacked them hard. And they cut his credit line in half. And he was like, what? Like, dude, we do shows there. We put on UFC fight nights there. And, you know, he's gambling a lot of fucking money. He's getting crazy. Right. But he won. He won a lot. And so they cut his ability to gamble in half. So he left the Palms. So he pulled the UFC fights out. and said, no, okay, we'll go to the Hard Rock now. What are you guys, retarded? Like, why would you do that? Like, you're going to get me eventually. Don't you know you're going to get me, you chicken shits? It's like they pulled his fucking credit. They
That's
were like, too much.
The exact opposite of what you're supposed to exactly. do if you're in the casinos. You want them back. You don't want them to send them away.
But
they
you know
just
what?
Won.
You get numbers crunchers who don't understand human nature. Yeah. And they just look at it as a, like a management tool thing.
Well, to get back to our risk management, I think there's a little bit of them going, I don't know how he's gaming the system, but I can judge from the results he's up to something. Cut this guy. He's counting cards. He's this or that. Just get him out. Just get him out.
I don't think he can count cards. I mean, I guess he can, but in blackjack?
But my point is, they don't know what the next scam is, and they can sometimes deduce that something's going on when those odds and averages that they've worked out to the nth degree don't seem to be working with you.
Right. Well, if you're a smart player, mm-hmm. that definitely has an impact mm-hmm. on blackjack. Like, blackjack is absolutely a skill game, yep. right? And I know they use a gang of decks now. They don't just mm-hmm. use one deck. So I bet you can most certainly count those cards, but I think you have to be like a super genius.
Yeah.
You have to be somebody like way smarter than Dana. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. He ain't counting cards. He's just getting lucky. He just knows how to play. You know, he'll tell you. He's not a fucking math genius. He's a business genius. He knows how to promote fights.
Maybe that's because he brings Cain Velasquez with him and puts him right next to the other dude, to yeah. the croupier, and he's like, he won, right? Yeah, no problem.
I'm 100% in favor of gambling. I'm 100% in favor of liquor, too. Mm-hmm. I'm 100% in favor of all options on the mm-hmm. table. It doesn't mean you're going to indulge in all of them, nor does it mean that you should. Right. And a lot of the indulgences that are available right now are very unhealthy. Like we talked about the gambling one. I could go to Vegas. You could go to Vegas. We all could any weekend and gamble everything we own. I know a dude who worked with a guy. He worked with this guy for 10 years. For 10 years, this guy saved up all his money to go to Vegas. And his idea was he's going to go to Vegas and gamble and, you know, and win. He felt like that was his destiny. So he saved up, you know, X amount of thousands of dollars for 10 years. Lost it in the first 24 hours in Vegas. Came back home to Oklahoma and was just freaked out. Just literally, like, right. shell-shocked. Like, he had been attacked and raped by 100 ghosts. You know, he just, like, had this look on his face that he would never recover from. This poor prick, you know.
That's natural selection. He's going to go follow a preacher in Munster now. I mean,
you should. I firmly believe that you should know that that's possible. I think we all yeah. should know.
Big sign on the door. Yeah. You can lose walk in these doors and you can lose everything. Welcome.
Yeah, but I think that exists for everything. I mean, I think ultimately we have to learn from all these horrible examples that we see on TV and in the news, but every time some guy, you know, gets in a street fight and beats some guy to death and they're pulling him away, and we should all learn from that. Mm-hmm. You know, we should all learn from that and go, hey, you know what? The human body is a lot more fragile than we like to pretend it is. Who's that boxer that just fell into a coma? Did you hear about that?
No, I didn't see that.
The guy was recent. Who was it?
Fighting on HBO the other night.
Really?
Yeah. They put him in a coma.
And brain swelling?
Yeah, yeah, he had some swelling, and then when they put him in a coma, he had a stroke. His name is, it's really sad, man.
Oh, I just heard him interviewed.
Yeah, Magomed Abdusalamov.
Who was he fighting? I heard a pregame.
Mike Perez, excuse me. And Mike Perez is this badass Cuban boxer. It was a great fight, and that guy is, I mean, this is a perfect example of a guy being too tough for his own good. Magomed took a tremendous amount of punishment in that fight, but kept trying. He just kept trying to
get it. Did he make it through the bout?
He made it through the bout. I think it was a decision, I believe. It was a 10-round decision, yeah. And he took just a furious amount of damage in that fight. And afterwards, they found out that he had broke his hand and broke his nose. He was taken to the hospital where a small blood clot was discovered on his brain. And so they induced him in a medically induced coma, and then while he was in the coma, he had a stroke. So it's pretty bad.
That's what's made boxing hard for me. I've always been a huge boxing fan, and it's football's getting a little like this, where you start to wince. You know, you can't. It's funny. I know this is stupid to say, but I would watch boxing, and I never connected it with pain. You know, you're watching tactics and you're watching different strategies working with each, and you're watching foot movement and head movement. And it never even occurred to me that you're watching, you know, the pain and the suffering. And then someone dies and you go, okay, how much enjoyment did I get out of this sport? And I still watch it, but this is the kind of thing that just reminds you of what's going on in there.
Well, for me, it has an even deeper connection because I've competed, because I've fought a few kickboxing bouts, and probably I don't know how many Taekwondo bouts, but it was over a period of like six or seven years. It was all I did with my life. It was my 100% waking life. So I competed a lot in full contact tournaments, and I got away with it. I got lucky, but I've seen some guys get really hurt. I've seen some guys get kicked in the head where they were just really never the same person again.
Doesn't this go to what you were saying, though, about, you know, you kind of have a right? You know, it's like, yes, if you talk to these boxers who are, like you said, every day they're training, you're going to tell this person they can't do that long as they know the risks?
To this day, that was one of the most important things that I ever did as far as developing me as a human being, because it was terrifying. It was terrifying, and I got really good at it. And I got really good at competing in a really dangerous, high-risk, quick happening situation, like the striking, especially at like the weight class that I was kickboxing at 160. And these light guys, everyone moves really fast, they all hit hard. It's a scary weight class, a lot of knockouts. Mm-hmm. And when you're competing in that sort of an environment, you're training in that sort of environment on a regular basis, regular shit just doesn't scare you the same way. Regular people, and they flare up and yell, or someone gets douchey with you, it doesn't have this overwhelming sense of fear that it has on a lot of people. And I've seen people in confrontations where a guy and another guy are in a confrontation, and something happens mostly because one guy, like, loses his ability to stay calm. Yep. Like, he's so confused and nervous that he can't react properly. When I see that, I see that's a human with a deficit in the development of their character.
I don't think, unless you have been there, I don't think that physical violence is something that you're just born knowing how to deal with.
No.
You know, it's like either you are used to it because you got beat up a ton as a kid, or you're used to it because you fought a lot, or you're used to it because of something. But you're not going to, you know, the first time it happens, it's fucking scary.
That's why the scariest kids to fight are kids who got beat by their dad.
Yeah. Exactly.
Those kids, though, I remember competing against kids that I knew had like really violent relationships with their fathers. Those kids were like really used to getting hit.
Yep.
It was a different thing. Like, and they it was a part of normal everyday life getting smacked around.
Well,
fucked
and
up.
You know, though, and this gets me back to not thinking about the pain in boxing. I remember there was a Ryan O'Neal, I think it was. He was doing the remake of the Champ movie, and they had on site one of these actual boxers who was going to kind of, you know, teach him a little bit about how to do this or that. And he tells the story. He says at one point he goes, the boxer who was working with him said, "I want you to hit me." And he said, "Okay, I'm not going to hit you. You know, long time. Hit me. You got to hit me." So he finally hits him. And he goes, "No, I mean really hit me." You know, and he says, "I squared up and I hit him as hard as I could." He goes, "No, I mean really hit me." And you start to realize that guys who take lots of punches all the time in training and everything, that they're it doesn't do to them what it would do to you. Well, not you, me. but to them, the punches can do just as much damage to their brain, but in terms of shaking them or hurting them, it's not the same thing when you're used to it.
Well, it's one of the big things is the shock of being hit. The shock of being hit is how a lot of people, they literally go into a freeze mode, and they can't move correctly, and they get knocked out. Like, their body shuts off. And it's being overwhelmed by the moment, by the fact that you're actually engaged in hand-to-hand combat with somebody. That's a weird feeling. I've seen it happen. I've seen guys fall apart, like in street fights and stuff. I've seen street fights that happened just because a guy was scared.
Yep.
You know, that's a possibility too.
Yeah, because then the more scared you are, the more you call for it, because then you're encouraging the other. Because if you're not scared, it's like, then makes the other person think twice. He's like, I really want to get into with this crazy motherfucker who's not scared of getting hurt?
It also doesn't progress the correct way. You know, the way that, like, the natural way in a idiot's mind is, I yell at you, you either back down and get scared and I kick your ass, or you yell back at me and we fucking puff chests until somebody fucks up and makes the wrong move. But if a guy backs down, you know that you can press forward.
Yep.
And the natural instinct of the bully is to press forward.
Yep, big it's time.
It's almost unavoidable. I think that's people do themselves a huge disservice by not understanding at least some form of martial arts, at least having some experience in it.
You know,
hopefully so that we won't need it, though.
That book that we are talking about right before we come on, with
Xenophon,
the Persian expedition, one of his speeches when there are these 10,000 Greek guys, like, way behind enemy lines in Persian territory. They have to make their way back home. He looks desperate. They have no chance. And one of Inis sort of, in this like speech that he's trying to give them to rally them up, one of the things he says is exactly what you were saying about the psychologies. If you guys are scared now, you're all going to die. There's just no way. Because if you're afraid of dying, that's exactly what's going to happen. Mm. If you guys are willing to die because you know that your odds are desperate, but you're willing to just go for it because A, you don't have any other chance, B, you go for it with honor, the odds are not only you're going to behave honorably, but your chances of surviving improve dramatically.
That makes sense. The universe favors bravery. Doesn't want weak bitches out there spreading their seeds. Sorry. That's a fact. It's a fact.
Right.
You know, there's a weird trend today to like almost like encourage weakness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think encouraging kindness is always very important, but it gets really confused with encouraging weakness. There's a lot of like bitch ass men out there that it would help them. It would benefit them. Take a fucking boot camp class, you know? Just do something with your body other than sitting.
That shit drives me insane because, you know, the fact that we have moved beyond the stupid stereotype of the tough macho man and the prissy woman who stay back, that's nice, but at the same time, so often has come at the price of people giving up the good sides of the stereotype. You know, if the stereotype of the man was you're strong and tough, but you're also, you know, emotionally deficient and not very sensitive, rather than working on the kindness aspect, as you put it, the idea has been, well, then strength is bad. We should get rid of that.
And yeah.
That's
ridiculous.
So stupid is not
well,
even funny.
Well, people associate prejudicially anything male, masculine, anything unapologetically masculine with suppression of the feminine, with suppression like with anti-feminist ideas. Like, I have on more than one occasion gotten into it with people that call themselves feminists, and their idea was that something that I'd said like doesn't promote femininity or is anti-feminine. This the furthest couldn't be true. I just expect a balance.
Yeah,
I expect people to just be people.
Exactly.
You know, I don't. When you start looking at feminist or masculinist or you know, I don't. That doesn't mean shit to me. What means shit to me is, leave me alone, I'll leave you alone. I'll give you the right to do anything you want to do, but you can't say I'm an ape because I like working out, okay?
No,
you can't say I'm an asshole because I've got some fucking guns, all right? That's nonsense. If you're a man and you don't work out because it's not enjoyable for you, I totally understand. But the idea that someone who does or someone who does participate in manly type shit is an asshole because of that. Like I watched this one thing. It was this horrible piece that someone wrote about the rape in Ohio with those high school kids.
Yep.
One of the most disgusting aspects of male culture.
Yep.
This ability to get someone fucked up and do that to them and treat them as a subhuman. I mean, it is without a doubt one of the scariest, darkest aspects of men.
Yep.
That they can do that. But in this article, they were talking about how, let's just face the facts, all high school athletes are assholes.
Yeah, that's the logical conclusion that flowed from that. It's like, what the fuck?
It hurt my
head.
Where
was that?
That was a blog. It was a blog that somebody wrote. But it was just, I was like, oh, come. I mean, it was a very progressive, very left-wing blog that I visit sometimes. And they were actually saying that supporting the ideas of competition actually encourages people to treat people as subhumans.
That's an old idea.
What do you think about that?
Listen, I think we exist in a realm where it's going to be competitive no matter what you do. So I think to pretend we're going to de-emphasize these things doesn't do anybody any good down the road, because then once you drop them in life, they're not prepared. Well, it is a little bit like what you were saying about the fighting, but like with my kids, you don't want to crush anybody early on. You want to nurture them so that they can handle the competition. But if you don't teach them about competition, you're not preparing them for life.
Yep.
And that's when you're going to release them into a world where, I mean, if those people really don't want a competitive world, think about how much you would have to do to turn off the competitive world, how much intrusion there would have to be on all of our lives. There goes your stock market right away, right? I mean, the economy. Isn't that a little like what some of the really hardcore communist ideas were about, where different people have different capabilities, so forcing them to compete is inherently unequal because you and I are born different, so we'll compensate for that and blend it out. Sounds great in theory, but the amount of work it takes to recreate a whole system, you know, where you don't have competition, you don't have differences, is worse than the disease.
Yeah, even because you are treating people like they are sick, as opposed to treating somebody like you are going to teach everyone, man, woman, doesn't matter, that where gender doesn't come into play. Everybody should be strong. Everybody should be kind. Everybody should have both of the qualities that are normally attributed to only one gender or the other. They are human qualities. They are good qualities. They are what you need to be a complete human being. You encourage that stuff, and you make the most complete human being there can possibly be, and they will deal with whatever shit life throws at them, competitive or otherwise, because there are always going to be challenges. And as you say, if there are no preparation for the challenges that are going to come your way, whether you like it or not, no matter how safe you make the world, then you're dead meat already. You know, then you're going to get squashed the first time the universe goes boo at you. You're going to freak out and crash.
For me, the big question in a competitively based system is not the competition part and not the winning part. It's what do you do with the people who come out on the short end of the stick? Because I think in a sink or swim system, you're going to find that the people who are sinking are going to decide that the system sucks.
Yes.
And we're going to change it because right. there's too many losers.
Yes.
I've always said that one of the things that you do when, you know, I said in a recent show that, you know, poverty is going to come back to bite us all in the ass one day if we don't do something about it. Not because you should care about poor people, but because eventually if they're hurting enough, they will make you care about them.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
They will turn the system around. I mean, you could outcompete them all you want, but they'll come and burn down your nice house at a certain point. So to me, when you talk about a competitive system, the winners aren't the issue. It's what you do with the people, because you're going to have some losers in a competitive system. How do you mitigate the downsides of that? And that's what I always try to think about.
That's a very good point. That's a very, very good point. You're always going to have good and bad in the world. You're always going to have conflict. You're always going to in the ability to recognize that and deal with whatever comes in front of you is very important.
Well, like you said, you're going to have kids who get raised by parents who beat the hell out of them and who don't raise them the right way and who don't give them those qualities, Daniele, that you were talking about. And then you're going to unleash those people in the world and say, go compete with this guy who went to Harvard and had a great education and was born with a lot of money. The world's an unequal place.
Yeah.
You can't fix that, but you can build that into your thinking, I think.
Well, it's also, there's such a broad spectrum of human beings and what the human being, where they fit into society, where their place is. Like, I have a lot of friends that have, like, zero willpower, but they make amazing stand-up comedians, you know, and that's where they,
the two might go together.
they very well might. Like, Joey Diaz is my favorite example. I mean, Joey has willpower. He gets up in the morning, everything like that, but he's, you know, 300 and whatever pounds. He doesn't give a fuck, and he's an animal. He's a savage.
Right.
But he's also the funniest human being I've ever met in my life. It's like, you can't make a Joey Diaz if you get some guy who's doing fucking sit-ups every morning, 1,000 sit-ups and chin-ups and jogging around the block and only eating kale. It's not going to be that guy. You need a guy who went to jail, did a lot of coke, you know, kidnapped a guy. You need all that, you know, like, in order to get a guy who's that wild and crazy and funny. And I feel like the real problem that we have in raising children is all they teach in school is to try to filter you into a standard position in the economy, standard job, whether it's they filter you towards a career and one or more very definable things.
Right.
There's a lot of people out there with talents that never get nurtured. They just can't figure out their way in that system because what's taught them is so small. Such a small chunk of the spectrum is taught.
Well, because schools are designed to make you average. That's what schools are about, which if you are considerably below average because of your opportunities in life, great. That's a step up. But if you're not, and that goes for the other 50% of humanity, then it's just designed to make you not nurture your talents, not do all those things, and try to make you fit in that little box. And part of the reality is that not because the people who create schools are evil and they just want to fuck with your life, is because they need to go with something that knowledge as something that can be objectively tested. What is that you can objectively test? Can you test somebody's wisdom, how smart they are, how cool of a human being they are objectively? Not really. What you can do is you can test how well they spit back information at you, which is a skill in itself that it's better than not knowing how. You need to have the discipline. You need to know some things. It's cool. It makes you. It gives you those average qualities. But it says nothing about what you're going to do with them, whether you're going to be brilliant, whether you're going to be able to use these ideas in an amazing way. And the reality is that gets to most people in charge of schools feel that's too subjective. When you start talking about wisdom, what the fuck is wisdom? Is your wisdom is not my definition, so we can't really test it. What we can test is... And so you go back to the, they don't want to get sued by the people who don't do well. Like if I come into class and I say, I'll give you an A because you're really fucking smart and I can see it. No, you really are not that good. So sorry, you got a C. The person who got a C is going to be, fuck you. You know, why are you giving me, show me why, you know, where is in the exactly that I deserve this. And part of the game is the stuff that you can prove in that fashion is not the kind of knowledge that make a complete human being. Is the kind of
but the application of that knowledge in a capitalist society is what we try to define as proof that you've actually got some intelligence.
Basically,
that's why people who you know you might not even think they're that smart, but if they're very successful financially, you go, well, he's smart at that,
right?
You know, it's there's that thing.
Mm-hmm. I think what you're trying to do theoretically in an education system is to prepare people to succeed in life. And the problem that I think the education system has is that it's stuck in a design for an era where succeeding in life is very different than succeeding in life today. You're not going to go onto the factory assembly line. You're not going to do those kind of things. But the way our system has evolved is to create people who can succeed at that. The problem is that what we have now is a creativity-based economy that we're moving towards. Mm-hmm. And teaching creativity, one, would be is tremendously hard. And we haven't worked to create that on a mass system where you've got schools that are – I mean, obviously schools work with creativity. But it's a different thing entirely to sit there and go, we're going to start in the first grade, and by the time you graduate high school, we are going to maximize your creative abilities that are unique to you. You know, Danielle, you were saying this. Part of the problem is you could talk about creativity, but Joe's creative gifts are going to be different than yours and mine, and you can't have a standard course.
Right.
Well, I haven't thought of one anyway, that can take your gifts and your gifts and bring them to maturity unless we all share those gifts because, you know, your gifts are in one area, your gifts are in another. The problem is that in our system, there are no assembly lines or few. You can't educate the mass of people to take a bunch of jobs that don't exist anymore. So I think the system has to redesign itself to push creativity.
And there's also some utopian ideals in raising kids that are contrary to human nature, like this new thing that they're doing where they're not having kids win. When, you know, when they're playing, like, ball games and no one wins, you know, when they're little.
This is back to your competition.
Yeah.
Yeah,
seriously, I would have been so pissed as a kid.
Have you ever heard of this before?
No.
It's a joke. I mean, it's... I mean,
oh, it's pretty widespread. It's been going on for quite a while.
Yeah.
Trophies for everyone, that kind of thing, yeah.
I don't know how I would Google that, but they're not giving out first and second place anymore. They're not, they're, you know... In,
well, let's not broad brush. I was going to say, some places.
You played, you don't keep score, you just...
Yeah, well, there's
another
idea.
Well, they don't do that. A lot of kids at the younger ages, they don't do that anymore. We kept scoring T-ball when I was a kid. And you rubbed someone's nose in it if they lost. There was no coach pitch. I had five-year-old boys who couldn't do anything but hit me with the ball, pitching to me all day.
There are no there are no losers. You're just the last winner. That's all.
I'm sorry. I have to go throw up. I'll be right back.
I mean, I think that competition, we all hate losing. And therefore, we connect competition with being a negative thing. I don't think it's a negative thing at all. I think competition is important. I think it's important in art. I think it's important in everything. You know, and you might say, "Oh, well, that's not the real spirit of art. It's not competition." You're right. It's not. But that competition can motivate the accomplishment of work. And the accomplishment of work, sometimes, you know, procrastination or what have you, can delay someone releasing their art. So in that way, the competition inspires the creation of art. It's not always, and most of the time you're better off with that competition being internal or not even being a competition, but rather an embracement of the complexities of figuring out whatever thing you're working on. But that's still there's something going on. There's a game going on. Whether it's going on with you in your head, whether it's going on with the audience that's going to review whatever you're creating, like a podcast, or whether it's going on with you and competing directly against your peers. And
There's something to me. I love something about competition because I love the immediate feedback it gives you.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you go out there, you do what you can to do, and at the end of the day, you see the results. You either pulled it off or you didn't. losing to me, as horrible as that feel, as it fucking sucks, and you feel like, you know, you're so mad, is the best thing that can happen to you, because that's, you know, winning, you're going to keep doing the same thing you've always done. You have no motivation to push harder, because, look, I'm already doing great.
Motivation may be fear of losing.
Yeah, exactly. And then when you do lose, then it forces you to go back to the drawing board and figure out, okay, how can I ran into this stumbling block, how can I go around it? And the fact is, you know, this bullshit about, you know, no losers, no winner, no, not letting somebody experience what it is to do your best and still lose, you're not doing them any favor. Mm. Because the fact is, in life, a million times, just because that's the design of life, shit is going to happen, whether you like it or not, whether it's fair or not, whether you deserve it or not. And how you respond to that, if you feel that, why did this happen to me? You know, it's unfair. It's, I shouldn't be in this place. I shouldn't feel like shit. Well, you do. Now what? You know, and that's that experience of losing. In that case, is you're losing at that game of life, not necessarily because of your fault. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. Now, are you, how the fuck are you going to respond to this? If you have been there a million times, maybe you have developed the muscle to grow out of it. If you have never been there, the first time that life slaps you around, you freak out.
And isn't that sort of one of the reasons why our economy and society itself is so fucked up? It's because we're so goddamn competitive, and it's because it's so natural to do that. When you start controlling some of the money, you want to control more of the money. You know, you when you start making some of the laws bend to help and benefit your business.
Right.
Dude, I watched a really disturbing documentary this past couple of days. It was Gasland. Mm-hmm. Have you seen that?
No. Heard of it. I haven't seen it.
Holy shit. You want to talk about a must-see. Hydraulic fracturing, what they call fracking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Wow. It's scary shit what they're doing. And this guy breaks it down, the amount of wells that they have. I had no idea.
Yeah, it's a lot.
And how many people's drinking water is forever poisoned. I mean, you're talking about giant chunks of America that are rendered poisonous.
Well, understand something. This is the wonderful example now of, you know, if somebody came to you and said, how much money would we have to give you to poison your country? What is that worth? Because look at the other side of this. Fracking, as it's called, has taken the United States from an energy really insufficient position where, I mean, we're in the Middle East, we're in all these places because of the energy question, and I mean, in a geologic sense, overnight turned us into an energy exporter again, and we haven't been that way since. I mean, we've always exported energy, but I mean, the 1960s were like the last really high water mark where we had lots of oil and we didn't have to worry.
Right.
All of a sudden, we're the natural gas kings and everything again, and there's a ton of money. That amount of money, the amount we're talking about here, and not just money for now, money for 10 years from now, 20, this is like long-term lots of money. That money will buy anything. It will buy poisoning your water supply. It will buy earthquakes that destroy small Oklahoma towns. It's an interesting thing to see what we're willing to sell for a ton of money. That doesn't go to Joe Rogan or Dan Carlin, by the way.
The problem is the word we. It's not what we're willing. Most people had no idea this was even happening until it was already too late. And during the Bush administration, this documentary, Gasland, highlights how this all came to be, and how Dick Cheney signed over these new exemptions that you didn't have to follow the Water Act, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. All those were exempt. Fracturing was exempt. So you could just fuck everything up in order to get to what's essentially like a small ocean of natural gas.
Mm-hmm.
The amount that's under New York and a big chunks of the country in Texas, it's huge. It's gigantic.
It's changed the entire energy situation on the planet.
But these people have water that comes out of their faucet that you can light on fire.
Yep.
You can light it on fire. There's more than 500 different chemicals that they have to pump into the ground in order to break up this natural gas and then extract it. And when they do that, they basically, everything gets mixed up together. The well water gets mixed up with the chemicals, gets mixed up with the natural gas, and it's just toxic as fuck. It's coming out of holes in the ground, and you can come up to it and light it on fire. It's madness.
Do you know what the best chance, and it's a sad thing, the best chance you have of combating that amount of money over something is when we have screwed up so much of the fresh water supply that the fresh water actually becomes worth more. Yep. And you're already seeing this happening in some places where they're talking about, you know, do we sell water rights to California from the Colorado River or this or that, the other? And the amounts of money that they're talking about, I mean, they're already talking about, you know, why should water be considered a feature that's owned by everybody? Mm-hmm. Can I buy the water in the Colorado River and then can I sell it back to you? So, I mean, the old joke is that if you buy the bottled water, it's worth more than gasoline, you know, at that amount if you go to the mm-hmm. store. Well, what happens when it really is worth more than gasoline right. in large quantities? Then all of a sudden, fracking sounds like you're destroying an even more important supply. I can get more money for that water than I can get for that natural gas. That's the only chance we have in a system driven by money, I think, to keep the water fresh.
It's incredibly short-sighted. And the amount of deception that's gone on to cover the amount of damage that's been done is staggering. Yeah. I mean, when these people tell their stories, it's incredibly hard to watch and listen to because people get sick because they were drinking the water. Their kids get sick. The water, like, for the longest time, they wouldn't admit that there was anything wrong with the water. And then they started giving people water. They set up these giant tanks and pump in water to them every week so that they get their water from that instead of their wells that they've had for, you know, 100-plus years. It's crazy shit, man. It's crazy shit to watch.
But this is where you see the corruption of our political system,
yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Which is what's destroying. You would think that people who live in places where they can light their water on fire would have their representatives in Washington working to stop that. But that's where your free speech rights and my free speech rights are not equal to the free speech rights of these other people. And this is where I always argue with the courts that say that money is free speech, which I don't mind, except who said you get 50 or 100 times my free speech rights?
Well, not that. The internet, I think, ultimately is going to be a place where people vote on things. And it's also ultimately going to be a place where people can donate to campaigns that promote values that they believe in. And I think that is going to be a special interest, along with all the other special interests in the world competing for influence.
But what about that line, if voting really changed things, they'd make it illegal?
Well, I think it's about money. And I think ultimately if people invest money in a party and a lobbyist and an idea that supports the things that they believe in, that money can influence people just as easily as mm-hmm. the money that supports fracking or the money support. The idea is that it's just trading of commodities here.
So let's buy a legislator. Should we get a group together? I'm taking up a cause. We're going to buy Senator Ron. Well, Senator Ron White is probably already on. But you know, this guy who's been working for the fracking industry. Mm-hmm. How much do you need, dude? You know, get him at the table. Go, how much is it going to take to bring you over to our side? I have powerful backers. The guy was, you know, cut off in Vegas. He can't gamble anymore. He's got a lot of money. You know. What's it going to take to buy this particular? I mean, maybe we should just do that. The part maybe that's unfair about this is that you're never offered the chance to buy a legislator. That's kept to a small group of people in a smoke-filled back room. Maybe what we need is, look, if you're going to be sold, give us the option of buying too.
We collectively have a fuckload of money.
Heck yeah.
We're dealing with 300
love to buy me a
legislator.
It's a write-off, isn't it? Can you buy a legislator? Isn't that a business expense?
Yes. You know, you
can't. It is if it helps my business.
You can't call it buying off, though. We have to call it something creative. Risk management diversification tool.
That's right. You know, you got that podcast troll lawsuit. I'm going to buy a few legislators and get them in my corner, and then I'm going to write that off, and U.S. taxpayers can pick up my buying of the, because that's how it's done at the best levels. You know?
Well, I think that ultimately that would be a smart thing for them to pursue just by virtue of the fact that there's more money there than there is in all the corporations combined.
I know, but it's a lot harder to please all of us than just that one guy.
You're right, but the potential for extracting money off of a giant group like 300 million, even if you get 1%, that's still a huge amount of human beings that are donating money.
Well, the audience is going to say that already exists. I mean, look at all the small contribution. Right. But it's not the same as walking up to somebody and saying, listen, I went to all my friends and here's $5 million.
Right.
Yeah, because the guy, you know, the corporation was going to, they are going to invest the money to buy off a vote to get what they want. They are going to make that amount of money 50 times over in the next year.
Right.
The person who's going to donate to a campaign, they are doing that in order to avoid something to be taken from them, whether it's clean water or something. They're not going to see that money back. They're not going to make more money on it. So there is a little bit of hesitance in a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like, fuck, really? Do I have to pay for something that I still had until yesterday? And, oh, man. You know, there's not that payoff of, like, you're going to win big. Is you're playing a defensive game where it's like you're just holding
on to whatever. It's a risk avoidance.
Yeah, it's sort of like you have that money and you have to invest it in making sure they don't rob you in the future.
Yeah, exactly. Rather than investing it to rob everybody else.
Yeah, one or the others. Either get your agenda across. But the idea that these companies that have enforced fracking or encourage fracking or spent money to make it happen. And this guy goes really clearly into detail about how it all took place. And they're ruining like a huge chunk of the country. Yep. And they're doing it right in front of everybody's face, and no one can stop it.
And the worst part is they won't be around when the bill comes due for cleaning up either.
You can't clean it up. That's what's really crazy. These people, one of the people that got incredibly sick, this woman got sick, because it turned out that these filters that they had set up don't work with the chemicals that they use for fracking. The chemicals actually eat the membranes of the filter. So some of the chemicals were getting through to her, and she was getting incredibly sick. Neurological damage, all sorts of, like, really, like, everyone's sick.
Right.
It's an incredible documentary.
It's very hard to protect the water supply. You remember here in California with that gasoline additive that sunk into the ground and made it into the water? And it was a weird situation because the additive had been put in there to take some of the lead from the air pollution, and then it was seeping into the groundwater, and so you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But that's the problem, is it doesn't take a whole lot to seep into the water supply, and then you're screwed.
Yeah, what was that you just put up that said gas lamp producers? Put it up. We'll put it up. Yeah. What does it say? That I don't know how they could mislead
anybody.
There's
a few debunking things about both documentaries on gas lamp. There's one and two, and they're both saying there's some...
But just put up the thing that I asked. Oh, the gas lamp producer misled viewers on... What
so
is it?
Joe said? Rogan is spreading false information.
Spread it out so we can see it.
It said that it's been happening since the 1930s. This isn't necessarily just from
the water was flammable before fracking.
You know what's funny though is every time you expose anything, you're going to have the next day 15 sites saying, "No, you made it up. It's not real. It's not da da da."
That's what public relations firms are for.
Exactly.
Right. Yep. Yeah, I think that. It's hard to know who the fuck is right in that situation, but somewhere in the country you can fucking, without a doubt, guarantee that these people have been poisoned. Whether the lighting the water on fire, it always existed, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Poisoning the citizens is an age-old thing. I mean, we do it at nuclear plants. We do it, I mean, there's been lots of situations where you're living near something that might be bad for you, and that's nothing new. That's what's crazy is that's always taken a back seat to somebody's profit somewhere. And that's a bit sad that we can't, as an entire population being poisoned, balance out the interests of those people who decide poisoning is okay because they can go to Hawaii.
Yeah, because, I mean, from their point of view, you know, you're a corporation, you're in the business of making money. You're not in the business of being nice. You're not in the business of being mean. Is whatever it takes to make money, you'll do it. If it takes screwing people over, oh well.
Well, and even if you didn't want to make money, you may have a fiduciary responsibility to your shareholders to maximize that. Wouldn't that be funny? I don't really want to frack.
Right.
But, you know, the shareholders will take me out if I don't.
But that's the problem. Yeah.
I'll go to jail.
That's the corporation, right? The role of government in a beautiful abstract world would be that they actually enforce laws to stop the stuff that's damaging to the public that's only good for those.
Well, Joe brought up loopholes. You brought up a loophole. And to me, that's the biggest thing that I think people don't understand, is that you can make all the laws in the world. If you let the loopholes happen, they don't mean it. It's like people say to me, Dan, why do you keep saying the Fourth Amendment's going away? The Fourth Amendment's there. Courts rule on. Yeah, but you Swiss cheese that enough, and it doesn't matter anymore.
Right.
This stuff is meaningless unless it acts as a barrier.
Mm-hmm.
I got to research this now because a bunch of people on my message board are putting up all these websites that say that they're debunking Gasland. First of all, I would, without a doubt, imagine that if I was working for the fracking industry and someone put out a hit piece on fracking, that I would debunk the fucking shit out of it. Even if it doesn't make any sense, the debunking doesn't make any sense.
And if you're a legislator who voted to allow it, you'd have the same interest.
Yeah, but that said, I haven't read any of the debunking, so I'll read that and I'll get back to it.
But even if you don't focus on the specific example, you look at the general picture, it's fucking undeniable that we're poisoning our environment. That I don't think you can debunk that. It's like, no, that's just facts. So you pick one specific example that may not be exactly 100% true. Who the fuck cares? The general picture remains the same, you know. That's not going to change.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that we do really, without a doubt, have an issue with the fact that people are super competitive and that people are progressive in nature. I mean, what I mean by progressive, they move forward. If they have $2, they want $3. If they have $3, they want $4. It's a natural, weird thing that we do. I was trying to explain anal sex to somebody And I was, and a girl,
because it's a natural segue.
Like, why do guys want to do that? I go, because they have regular sex with you, and then they go, can I put it in your mouth? And they go, yeah. And they go, okay, what about that? And that's just, it's a natural, weird progression. I mean, all that stuff happens. When you hear about, like, crazy,
how were you not a philosophy major, Joe? That's all I want to know.
When you hear about, like, crazy super freaks that have, like, gigantic orgies, how did that happen? Did they just start off having orgies? No. They started out with regular sex, and they got a lot of regular sex, and they started getting bored, so they brought in extra girls. And before you know it, they're having these freaky sex parties. It's a natural thing of progression. People, if they can run 5 miles, they want to run 10.
Right.
If they got their brown belt, they want to get their black belt.
So it's competition, which you guys were talking about how great it was all the time, and now you're slamming.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I say it's the ideas gone wild. The idea of what makes a human exceptional, what makes a human create everything that exists, really. I think from electronics to the wheel to houses and everything, there's this natural desire for humans to improve upon what they've already done. And I think that extends to control. I think it extends to evil as well. It's one of my arguments when everyone would talk about, like, problems with government and whether or not there's still corruption in government. All you have to do is look back on the corruption that you can document for a fact that happened in the 1960s and know that there's no bodies. There's no, like, a slew of people, lives ruined, careers destroyed, parties brought down. No, it's actually very little. If you think about exactly what they're absolutely positively guilty of doing, there's very little damage. And you know that everything progresses. Mm-hmm. So the amount of utter and complete total corruption that exists today and the sophistication of it would naturally be above and beyond what existed documentable from the 1960s.
Let me take it to a different level, because I think it's a different thing. I think that we are incentivized as human beings, going back to primate times, to look at things through a short-term lens. Mm. The carrots and sticks are all set up for the short-term approach. You know, you brought up wisdom a while ago, Danielle. Wisdom is being able to look at things from a long-term perspective. Now, a perfect example is investing. In the old days, you know, Ty Cobb would buy Coca-Cola shares. And when he died, he had all these Coca-Cola shares on his chest in the hospital that he'd had for forever. You know,
his chest.
Oh, yeah, he was so afraid someone would take his so he kept it. So he's got all these shares he's owned forever, because to him, he wasn't going to sell them in 5 minutes. He was in it for the long term. Our society is set up for the short term. Making money is set up for the short term. There is no interest in saying something like, well, let's protect clean water. Who are you protecting it for? Right. I won't be around to enjoy that clean water. By the time that happens, I'm dead. Now, what can I make in the short term? Politics is the same way. It's like when people were talking about President Obama lying about the health care plan, about keeping your own doctor, right, and all that stuff. He's incentivized to do that. All he cared about was winning that next election. You will worry about the fallout later. None of this matters if you lose, right? Deal with the fallout of the lie later. There's no incentive to not lie.
Yeah.
The incentives are all on the, you know, and this is if you're an intelligent human being, weighing the pros and cons. You are not incentivized to think long term, and yet that may be the only solution for the planet. You talk about long term. If we can't somehow contradict where the incentives are and go against our natural primate instincts, we might not be able to make it work.
I think it's going to take a greater level of awareness culturally than exists today. Mm-hmm. I think the great level of awareness, the really truly objective view of humanity and the potential possibilities of the future, is something that's contemplated by few groups, small groups of people sitting in conversation, dinner parties and stuff. But if you think of the greater whole of humanity, the amount of damage we're doing to the world on a daily basis, the amount of, like, really ridiculous behavior that operates our financial and justice system and our political systems, it's all, like, complete and total chaos, and yet it still continues in the exact same way it always has before. There's only small groups of people that speak out against it. I think once the sphere of understanding of, like, what a complete disaster this world is because of our actions and because of our inability to correct those actions, once that understanding is in place, then hopefully it's not too late. There'll be some sort of way to turn back the tide. But I feel like it's an ebb and a flow thing, much like everything in life. And I think it's almost like we have to fucking poison the ocean mm-hmm. before we realize it's ridiculous and then stop doing it.
I think it's going to be money. I think somewhere down the road, when clean water, for example, is worth a bazillion dollars to Halliburton and they buy the water, then the rules will be you can't piss in water anywhere because, you know, you might. Right. Then all of the money going to Washington will be to preserve water. Preserve Halliburton's water supply, otherwise their profits will be impacted when they sell it back to the public. Joe, you always need, you know, you want human nature to improve and you think it's going to happen, and I don't disagree with you. The problem is that so many people like Dick Cheney have to be improved too before this works that I don't see that happening. I see it going the other way. Their incentives have to become – they're still going to want money. They're still going to think short term, but the incentives have to change so that protecting the environment becomes the way to keep your millions intact as opposed to, you know, polluting the environment becomes the way to keep your millions intact.
Maybe, but if you look at the dissolving of boundaries between people and information and how that trend is going to continue. I think that our idea of looking at the possibilities of the future based on how humans were able to run the world just 10 years ago are kind of ridiculous. When you think about it from 100 years from now, mm-hmm. the options won't be available because the amount of transparency that will be required to communicate with people is going to be completely different. It's going to be very hard to hold back reality.
You're assuming that there's not going to be some David Cameron crackdown, you know, between now and then.
I don't think they can do it. And I think even if they did, the young people that are coming up that are more in line with the ideas of an anonymous or the ideas of open source internet, the ideas of spreading information and what a massively important thing that is for society and human culture as a whole, I think they're overwhelming. And I think they're going to continue that trend. The people that know that the idea of anybody being able to control information, they're literally controlling, if they do that, they're controlling educational evolution. They're right. controlling the ability for the
Are you suggesting they wouldn't want to?
Can't. You can't do it. I don't think you could do it.
Is that a challenge?
It's like trying to pull all the sand off the beaches. I don't see it happening.
Some of the stuff that you guys are saying, I actually think it goes hand in hand, because what you're saying, Joe, about the fact that a certain level of transformation in terms of consciousness, in terms of priorities that happen at a mass level when enough people with sort of a critical mass, that feeds into Dan's argument that at that point, corporations are going to respond to it because there's money attached to it. So I don't think it's just purely from an economic standpoint, and it's clearly not purely from a consciousness standpoint, is going to go hand. I mean, it's happening now, right? It's like more and more people care about environmental
yes.
issues. So companies that market themselves as we're nice to the environment can hike their prices a little bit because they know that they are going to have some people who buy them their products because of those values.
Yeah, could you imagine if, you know, you were buying some gas that cost 10 cents less per gallon, but it, you know, it was guaranteed comes from like child labor and
right.
in some shitty part of the country, the world where
right.
they
it's the dolphin safe tuna label thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that it's going to be impossible in the future to hide any evil behavior. I think right now it's still too muddy. I think as technology advances and improves, this connection with people and ideas and information is going to be cleaner and quicker. I don't know what form that's going to take in, but all I'm doing is sort of objectively extrapolating what's happened in the past to what's happened recently to where I feel like it's going. I just don't think you can hold this waterfall back. I feel like there's too much going on. There's too many people communicating too freely all over the world and improving upon the methods of communication. And they're going to get to a point where you're not going to be able to hide a goddamn thing. And you're not going to be able to make money off of – you're not going to be able to profit off doing something that directly damages the earth because everyone's going to see it. It's going to be something that your neighbors know about. It's going to be something that we're going to know what each other are getting away with.
But don't you think you end up with a Gasland kind of story where you can push a story and maybe you twist 15% of the data to make your point a little harder, and somebody else, based on that 15 or 20% you're making up, debunk the whole thing and say it's all crap. And there's that part of the flow of information is that there's so much of it that for every single thing you hear that seems to prove things going one way, you have people who seem pretty credible, who give you good evidence to argue the exact opposite things, and it leaves a ton of human beings feeling like, What the fuck? I don't know which one of them to believe. This one sounds good. This one also makes sense.
Well, I feel like we're either going to go one way or the other. We're either going to go slide into complete total dictatorship brought out by a series of terrorist events, mm-hmm. or we're going to slide into the next level of evolution. And I think it's a battle right now. Was that quote from Orson Welles that history is, God damn it. I forget the quote. Amazing quote by Orson Welles, but essentially, to paraphrase it, what it was saying is that there's a race going on between people who are looking to improve the mm-hmm. human race and people that are stuck in the old paradigm that are constantly battle between education and fuck. Oh, God damn it. I hate when I don't remember a great quote that I think I have at my fingertips.
You need a quote board here up on the walls.
History, Orson Welles.
Human history becomes more and more a race between education and catastrophe.
There it is.
Good one.
And that's exactly what it is. I mean, that's exactly what we're talking about. I feel like the way things are going, when you hear people like the NSA folks say that, you know, the angry that a guy like Edward Snowden released all the data and he's a traitor and, you know, all this craziness where you're trying to convince us that this guy is bad because he told us that you're bad.
See, why can I always see the dark side? I want to come with you guys into the light. I really do. But see, all I see happening is another 9/11 attack and then the people in the NSA mm-hmm. going, guess what allowed that one? That right. was the stuff Edward Snowden told you. Now, mm-hmm. see? Now, don't you learn? Trust us next time and you won't have another one of these. Right. I just, you know, I mean, I think things could break in the right way, but I think history shows that they're stacked up against us. And so I think if you take this attitude that, hey, things could break the right way, you are not girding yourself up for the fight that you're facing. And this gets back to what we talked about when you talked about fights. If you think, mm-hmm. oh, that George Foreman I'm about to fight, ah, he's got openings. I watched him in tape. His left is slow. I'll get in on that. And then you don't account for the right, and you get in there and you go, oh, damn, I forgot about that. I think you need to gird yourself and say, history shows that there's always a small group of people, you know, who have a little bit of the ear of the powerful or who have mm-hmm. a little bit more money or what have you, and they're extremely formidable. There's never going to be like we all get this consciousness expansion and Dick Cheney's never getting anywhere near government again. The truth is we're playing Black Hawk Down and Dick Cheney's busy, you know, buying up corporations. And right. I think this is a monumental struggle that's going to require, you know, what's missing, and I've always said this, is we don't have any leaders. I mean, in other generations, you can name people, you can Wikipedia and search people that were out in the forefront bringing groups of people into directions. I feel like we're a very directionless group.
Except for Putin.
Dan Carlin for president.
And that's what you want. That's when you will really see how limited a person I am. I'm already at the height of my game. I don't get any better than this. So you put me up to president and it's all over. Then the reviews on iTunes will be horrible.
A guy like Putin is like one of the last real leaders. And in a leader in a very gangsterish sort yeah. of a way, but still,
he's old school,
as old school as it gets.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the guy was the president, and they say you can't be president anymore. He goes, "All right, I'll be the prime minister." This guy's the president now, fuckheads. Oh, you know, look, I'm the president again.
He is kind of showing a blueprint for how you take a new democracy and just mm-hmm. kind of. And the people wanted a democracy. And you just kind of convince them that the way you're doing it is better. And you interview these people in the street and they go, oh, Russia really needs a strong man. Really? When did you get convinced of that? Where's your awareness raising level and everything?
Just to play devil's advocate for what you said earlier, when you were talking earlier about you see it going in a bad direction, we were just talking at the beginning of this conversation about how fucked up things were just a few hundred years ago. Mm-hmm. Like how much worse things were 500 years ago. How much is that really correct? Were they really that much worse? And if that's true, then isn't there some sort of a marked improvement in society and the safety in society that we can demonstrate today?
Well, the fracking situation was better back then.
Yeah, the water was all clean.
No, it wasn't. It was converted with different things were messing up the water back
people
then.
People shit in their
that's
water,
that's right.
And yeah. bodies. They yeah. toss bodies in there. Yeah, I mean, there's always been people doing stupid shit to the ground.
Because they had short-term interest at stake.
Exactly. That's a very good point, that point that you had about people looking at it. And also, back in the day, I mean, up until recently, you didn't really live long enough to see the hustle.
Right.
You know, if you were lucky, you lived to be 30-ish, you know, and a good 50% of your friends were probably dead by then. And then, you know, the guys that would live to be 60, those rare birds that would be hanging around philosophizing in the square, they were so rare. Right. You really didn't get that many of them. So when you got a guy like Socrates that dropped all this crazy knowledge, like, yeah, that guy had been around a long time. He made it through, wrote some shit down, he figured it out. Most people, not going to get there. Most 25-year-olds today are half retarded. Try having a conversation with the average 25-year-old. Not all
of them. Don't worry, their awareness is going to compensate for that.
And believe you me, I know that a lot of you out there that are 25 are way fucking smarter than me. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it's you, but you know those other dudes.
Joe, a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. That's the proverb that applies to this whole short-term thing. If you think I might not even be alive to profit off this stuff later, but I can profit off it today, what are you going to do?
No doubt. But I mean, back then, you're dealing with like a whole society that was sort of structured on people that never got old enough or never had exposure to enough data to sort of go, I don't think we should have a Caesar. I don't think we should have this Colosseum. Hey, this whole Lions versus Christians thing, this is kind of fucked, man. Let's not do that.
But that's why Orson Welles' quote was so cool, because that's exactly what it is. Is the ugly side is insanely strong and in some way getting stronger. The potential for optimism, that's also happening. And it's one of those races where you're like, that's an interesting one. You can put the accent on either one. The reality is that they are both real. You know,
Isn't that sort of what we were also talking about competition earlier? That the yin and the yang, it's almost like you need opposing forces. Mm-hmm. You need a pull and a push. You need something in order to motivate change. It's almost the idea is that in order for society to get great or get better, it has to go through stupid shit. And if it doesn't go through stupid shit, it never gets anywhere.
That's why I'm curious I had a question for Dan on that, because I don't disagree with your view. I mean, there's a lot.
You're allowed to. Don't worry. I'm okay with that. Everybody else does.
No, I actually, most days, that's exactly how I feel. And even the days that I don't, I still feel that there's a lot of it that's true. So the point to me is, how do you turn that awareness that you're stuck up against something, you know, you're an ant trying to attack a tank, you know, you're the odds, what you can do, not even as any single individual, but even at mass level, feel sometimes so limited. And how do you wake up in the morning? You know, how do you deal with the fact that you have
kids, you're optimistic? There's a lot of beating off, drinks whiskey, powers down, double espresso shots.
Some of that is true. I actually talk about this on our political show, because when you feel the most upset about things and the most powerless, you start to wonder about the wisdom of caring about this stuff. And you look at people who don't. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all know people who don't pay any attention to politics, who don't watch the news, whose life is a very it's my kids, it's my wife, it's my job, and there are times when I question the wisdom of caring about things you cannot change.
Right.
Then someone else will say, well, with that kind of attitude, you can be guaranteed you won't change it. Yes, but there are some forces at work that if you alone have to do it, it is an ant against a tank.
Right.
And at some point you look and you go, okay, it's me and Rogan and Daniele, and that's not enough. I might as well do what I can. In the 1960s, they used to say, you know, look at the man in the mirror, take care of yourself first. Sometimes that's all you can control. Mm. But if that's the way you look at it, you're letting the Dick Cheney's, I'm using him as my Darth Vader figure for everything today. But I mean, then you let them win.
Could you imagine if you got Dick Cheney high on mushrooms?
I'm not sure that he wasn't the whole time.
I mean, it might explain some things. He would never have that sort of the mushrooms.
You thought he shot that friend of his just totally sober and straight?
Oh, he's drunk.
Okay, well now
we. Well, he was clearly not only is he drunk and not clearly drinking, but he avoided the police for like 13 or 14 hours.
You think there weren't Secret Service guys there too? How do you not tell him to put the gun down, pointed toward the ground?
Well, that's how you know what a real gangster is. He shot his friend in the face, and his friend apologized.
Yeah, that is actually very good. That is a good.
His friend was like, "I'm really sorry. Dick's a great guy.
I didn't mean to cause you all this trouble with the media, Mr. Cheney.
I shouldn't have my face in the path of your bullet. I'll try to make up.
I'm very bird-like in my movements. I'm tricky. I think like a bird sometimes when I'm hunting birds, and he probably tuned into that vibe. Just shot me in my fucking face.
There have been times that I've been, you know, when just carrying the weapon quite wrong, and you know.
Well, where's the Secret Service to take credit for that? Why didn't they say they accidentally shot the dude?
Right.
Why the fuck did you tell
if they're willing to take a bullet for somebody.
Yeah. How did that go? How did the guy not say he accidentally shot himself?
Well, but nothing happened, right? So it doesn't matter. Yeah. You could say
a little bit of bird shot in the face, you know.
Bird's shot is very small, people. I'm not saying try a wad in the face.
You know, you've got a few mannequins here that we could conduct some experiments on.
Yeah.
You know, how does that alien thing handle the bird shot?
Well, there's a reason why it's so small is when you shoot into something like a pheasant, you can't really shoot it with a fucking 12-gauge. Right. It'll blow a hole through the bird.
Screws the meal up, too,
yeah,
later.
Yeah, it's useless. It's filled with little pellets.
Right.
The fucking half the thing is blown apart. So you got to have like a little... So that's what the old guy got hit with. Just a little baby bird shot in the face. No biggie.
Tough it out.
Now Dick's got a new heart. Isn't that hilarious? What, imagine if he had a new heart and then they put it in and he just started fucking feeling really regretful for everything and started writing books.
Did you hear the line he said that and I didn't read the story. Sometimes I just read headlines, so you just have to ignore me on this. But do you remember that story about Dick Cheney where he said he feared having his heart hacked or whatever?
Yeah, of course he did.
Because he knew what he would have done in the same situation.
Absolutely.
I'm hacking Joe Rogan's heart right now.
Which leads me to believe you and I had exchanged a couple tweets and emails regarding this Michael Hastings thing.
Yes.
How fascinating that whole story was. Michael Hastings, the journalist who was very aggressive towards members of the military. And
he was aggressive toward everybody, I think.
Yes, very aggressive. And aggressive towards like these guys who are fucking... killers on a global scale. You know, when you get to be a 4-star general or what have you, like, you're fucking real good at killing people.
Yeah.
You know, there's no other way around it. No other way to get there. And this guy was being aggressive towards them.
Have you changed your mind? Have you altered your view on that at all?
I have zero opinion. I don't have an opinion one way or the other. I looked at it, watched the video of the car slamming into the tree, and I thought, wow, that was... most likely, some sort of a remote control device that caused him to slam. That's when I started reading that people said that. But I've also read that a lot of people believe that he was unstable, and a lot of people believe that he might have been doing drugs. And that's possible, too. I mean, the kind of guy who's so risk-taking that he's willing to go after generals, like, that kind of guy might do a lot of wild shit.
Right.
I think it's possible, though, that they can do that to a car. I think that's what I've gained from this. What I've gained from this is by reading the experts, the technology experts, the people that have no vested interest in this politically one way or the other, weren't a Hastings fan or denier, the people that looked at the possibilities for what you can do with a remote-controlled system in a car now, and they can do it. They can make your car do things. And the people that are were formerly in the CIA have come out about it and said that they believe that the technology exists. And it makes sense.
And even before it existed, remember the guy who had done all the exposing of the CIA crack cocaine epidemic, like basically accusing the CIA of having helped Latin American drug lords who happened to be their friends.
Which guy is this? Barry Seal?
You know, I can't fucking remember the name. I just remember that he was, he owns the record for having, quote unquote, killed himself by shooting himself with a shotgun, so far nothing strange, twice. Which seems a bit complicated to pull off.
Hmm.
The most interesting thing about the Hastings thing to me now, because I'm with you. I don't know what you could figure out from Hastings based on what we know. I was fascinated, and this gets to your new media thing, all the information out there, and it also gets to yours, Daniele, about false information or muddying the waters. Do you realize how much of what circulated the globe about this Hastings thing came from that one source, that part-time contributor to that local news station in San Diego, that Kim Dvorak woman? She's the one who said things like, well, there was no body in the coffin, and everyone was upset with that. Well, that turned out to be totally false. But oh my Lord, did we all share that? And did everybody hear that? And most people not ever hear the retraction. That one person saying something that was not true created that so much of the foundation for where we all started. Because that's when I freaked out. I said, wait a minute. You know, the coroner didn't give the body back and cremated it without permission. That is, if you've ever dealt with coroners, and that's just not kosher.
And that turned out to be not true.
And I don't think she ever retracted it. But that one, you know, in the old days, they used to make us confirm sources twice. She's in the position where she's supposed to be confirming sources twice. She says that the San Diego news station runs it multiple times, and then we all retweet it and share it, and it becomes part of the urban legend almost. But that a single strand, one person was able to do that with the global sharing and everything, that to me is as fascinating as the Hastings thing.
I agree. I think it's just as fascinating. And the real desire to know one way or another is just a natural part of human curiosity. We want to know, did someone assassinate this guy, or did he go wacky and drive 100 miles an hour into a tree? Both are possible.
Sure.
The reality is, I don't know. And so, you know, I say, when you say, did I change my opinion? I don't have an opinion. When I first looked at it, and I said, wow, that looks like that, but I wouldn't be betting on it.
Right.
You know, a lot of weird shit happens. Yep. Just naturally.
I've heard of... There's another element, Joe. And the element is an us versus them kind of thing.
Right.
I mean, we felt people like yours truly, anyway, felt like Hastings was on our side of the fence, right? He's reporting on stuff that we're going, thank goodness, finally somebody's doing this, right?
Right.
And then all of a sudden he's gone, and in a weird situation, I mean, I think the tendency is to say, one of our guys got it in the neck, and he got it in the neck for doing something that we've been waiting for someone to do, and what does this say to the other people out there we would hope would... So, I mean... I don't want to say teams, but there's a part of me that says, to me, I don't know if I would have liked the guy on a personal level, but he was on my side.
Yes.
And I feel like, God, the powers that be have everybody on their side. I mean, so I mean, there was a feeling like, please tell me that somebody working for the good of all of us didn't get knocked off. I don't think he did, but there's certainly that feeling where you just go, what sort of a message does this send to other would-be Michael Hastings?
You don't think he did, but would you be surprised if you found out he did? If he did get you found out he got knocked out, I wouldn't be surprised.
There's a book called Poisoning the Press concerning a reporter who was the Michael Hastings of his day, but 1,000 times bigger, named Jack Anderson from the early 70s. And Anderson actually had the Nixon administration officials, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, those guys, talking about potentially killing him. A guy whose show I was on several times, G. Gordon Liddy.
Yeah.
Liddy was volunteering to kill him. They were going to run him over with a car. Now, I always think to myself, okay, so the plot never happened, but they were discussing it at the highest levels of government, and that's what makes you go, maybe this Hastings thing isn't that far off the wall. I mean,
I don't think it's far off the wall at all. I just don't know what happened.
Yeah,
no, me either. Yeah. Not at all. And I tend to go with the safer answer when in doubt. You know,
sure. I mean, that's a nice way of not looking stupid too.
Which is, of course, my goal in life, right?
It's too late for
me. Too late, exactly. Me too.
So I just dive right into the stupid side all the time and go, what if? Because the what if is always there.
Let's hope they're grading us on a curve.
Well, that's the unfortunate reality of history, isn't it? That if you really do pay attention, you go, well, they've done it before. Well, there's been, you know, people have conspired. They've gotten away with it. They did. They did false flags. They lied to get us into wars. They lied about certain actions that were going on. They assassinated people and lied about that and then got caught.
They had a short-term incentive. Yeah. Same thing.
Yes. Always has been.
The thing that's weird is, though, when people are doing the exact opposite of what we're doing right now, which is, you know, it could have gone this way. It could have also realistically gone this way. I don't have the evidence either way. And people bet their lives one way or another.
Yes.
And they're like, I know that this is what happened and there's this conspiracy. Or, no, you're totally full of shit. It could never happen. And it's like, how the fuck do you know?
I got out of an argument online the other day on my message board about the JFK assassination. I get to that when I just go, okay, I'm good. I got to step away. I know too much about the JFK assassination. I've studied it for far too long. And it drives me absolutely fucking bonkers when I see people that are 100% convinced that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
Right.
I'm like, I don't know if Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone, but guess what, fuckface? You don't either.
Right.
And the reality of the evidence is not that cut and dry.
Yeah.
The Warren Commission itself was a massive contradictions. It was clearly designed to achieve a predetermined conclusion, and they ignored all evidence that went contrary to that predetermined conclusion. And that conclusion was there was a single shooter.
Are we going to go into this? Are you opening this topic for discussion?
I'm not.
Your message board will love this.
My point is that when I see people argue, I don't know if he acted alone. He might have acted alone.
Right.
I leave that open. But when you see that stupid bullet that supposedly went through both of their bodies and shattered bone and came out looking all pretty and beautiful, you're like, get the fuck out of here. Well, that just showed up on Governor Connolly's gurney at the hospital. It just magically was there in perfect shape, and it just happened to be from the same rifle that you're attributing to the guy who's dead now, who got shot by a fucking mob man.
Right.
Come on.
Now I have to jump
in. Stinks.
I changed my mind on this subject.
Look at that bullet, Dan Carlin.
I've seen the magic
shut
bullet.
Your pie hole.
But you know what's funny is that I don't dispute any of those things. What if the government had a really good reason that you would have approved of
to kill Kennedy?
No, to cover it up. And we're doing a podcast on the First World War right now. And Kennedy was famous for having given The Guns of August, the book that's about the lead into World War One and how nations were kind of sucked into something they didn't want to do based on an assassination of a world leader sitting in an open car next to his wife, by the way. And if you're Lyndon Johnson and you're the people around Kennedy, and it's a year after the Cuban Missile Crisis, right? You almost have World War III a year ago. Mm-hmm. And a guy kills a young, popular president in front of his wife, who's, you know, in there in the Chanel clothes with the blood and brains all on her. And his children are orphaned and you're mad as hell. And the guy's tied to communism like nothing. I mean, he's fair play for Cuba committee. He's one of the few people who defected to the Soviet Union. He's one of the very few that came back. Would you maybe be worried that the American people would be so angry and so ready to somehow punish the communists who may have even been behind this attack? I mean, you can create a scenario where it might have been a national security interest to, as much as you can, disassociate Cuba, communism, and the Soviet Union from the assassination of the president, because even if it didn't happen, can you see the Republicans in the administration back then going, we need to do, you can't let them get away with potentially shooting our president. Let's invade Cuba.
I'm a little confused. So yeah, I'm not surprised. Are you implying that you think that they made it look like Lee Harvey Oswald didn't do it? Because if he did do it, then that's communism killing the president.
No,
right?
I think what most of us, when I was on the side saying that I think there was a conspiracy, is you point to all the obvious things the government hid. And that to me is always a red herring, right? You say, well, they hid the magic bullet, couldn't have been this and that. And then you start to think, well, would there have been a good reason for a government cover-up? Well, the first good reason is because they did it, right? Mm-hmm. So you go, well, those bastards. Could there be a reason where you would sit there and go, oh, no, I understand why you did that. You did that to prevent a greater evil. And I'm not saying that that's the case, but once you sit back and do that, you go, there could be multiple reasons.
So you're saying they would blame it on Lee Harvey Oswald instead of blaming it on the Cubans?
No, I think they might try to obscure the idea that this was something involving communists, Cubans. And I think, can you imagine if Oswald had actually had to take the stand someday and testify about this and talk? I mean, this may have been the thing where the government said, listen, this is just one guy who did this, but it's going to open up a whole can of worms with the political opposition. I mean, remember, there were posters of John F. Kennedy saying wanted for treason in Dallas the day he was killed that the right wingers down there had pushed. What do you think they would say if Lee Harvey Oswald is tied to communism so closely a year after we just avoided World War III?
That's a really stoned idea. I think you must have been hitting the bong hardcore, and you decided that the
real conspiracy... I look at things from multiple angles, baby.
Hey, you may be right. I mean, look... I'm not asserting that.
I'm saying it's a possibility.
No, you got to throw it into the mix.
You do.
There's probably a lot
of weirdness. You're
going to
play the game where you throw all the other stuff into the mix.
Well,
the grassy knoll.
Jack Ruby had a direct connection to the mob. The mob had a direct connection to Cuba. Those three things are... that's a fact. Those are facts. And so Jack Ruby was assigned to go kill Lee Harvey Oswald in front of the police, thus sacrificing his own freedom to do so. He knew he was doing it while he was doing it. It was a total suicide bombing. That alone is a direct connection to Cuba.
Yeah, I'm all for, you know.
What is that noise?
I'm hearing it too.
Someone's car alarm.
I'm just glad your studio's not a whole lot better than mine at stopping noise.
Well, there has to be something like a car alarm for us to hear it, but how fucking dumb are car alarms? Nobody goes out and looks. When they were first made, people were like, this is it. There's going to be no more theft. You're going to hear this alarm, and everyone's going to run out with a gun. Nobody fucking pays any attention to car alarms anymore. They yell out, shut it off. Like if you're in an apartment building and it's going out, people open up their window and yell out, shut it off. That's all. They don't yell out, someone's breaking into your car. They don't believe in it.
Yeah.
They've cried wolf too many fucking times, those pricks.
Doesn't work.
Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying, though, because I'm all for thinking from multiple directions, but I stick with Joe's theory about the bong on that day. I agree. What I don't understand is the... what Joe was saying as an objection, the idea that if you're trying to avoid the communist connection, to avoid World War III, why in the world then would you want everybody to know that the guy responsible is a guy who has communist connection? You know what I mean?
Well, I think
then
you're stuck with that. I mean, you know, if they capture Oswald and they arrest him, you're stuck. The trial, if there's going to be a trial, is going to bring all this out. And imagine, that trial would have taken a year, would have been on TV. Mm. The people are just going to fume. You know, the communist thing is going to be brought up by the prosecution. I guess what I'm trying to say is, I tried to figure out, we always assume that when government covers up, it's to hide something from us we'll be angry about. Are there ever occasions where they cover something up because we would want to, if we were in the same position, for the good of things? Are there ever times when government covers stuff up for a good reason?
I don't think they're smart enough to do that. I really don't.
Well, you might be right.
I think that this Lee Harvey Oswald case, what it may very well be, is one of the best examples possible that we're living in a simulation.
Yes.
Because it's so theatrical.
Nick Bostrom's idea, yeah.
It's so theatrical. I don't know how many people have had that idea, but a lot of like really legit
guys. Physicists. Yeah. Oh, yeah. They actually have a mathematical formula that says it's more possible than not that we are.
Just look at the progression of technology and you think, like, where is it eventually going to go 1,000 years from now, 10,000 years from now? It's inevitable. If we don't blow ourselves up, we're going to be able to recreate reality, and it will be completely
indiscernible. It's an ant farm. We live in an ant. But here's the way you know it. We already play games on our computers that are really, really primitive versions of that already.
Yeah.
If somebody came out to you and said, hey, we've got the brand new version of Civ, and this time you'll have real people.
Yeah.
I mean, you'd be like, how much is that? I'm on that right now.
That's why it leaves that opening. Like, if that was real, where would it be? And if it was here already, would we know? If you're going to make it indiscernible, how do you not know it's not already there? And then there's things that are just so dramatic and so ridiculous, like the Kennedy assassination. It's such a perfect piece of theater, the way it ties up so loosely and leaves you with a bunch of confusing facts. And how about the fact that within the decade after the assassination, more than 100 witnesses to the crime are dead? Like, some of them died, they were murdered, right. People died in car accidents and strange diseases, and they were poisoned. And I mean, the odds are staggering that would happen, that 100 people who saw the assassination would die.
Okay, but you just said you don't think the government's smart enough to do this, that, and that. But
they're smart enough to murder people. That's pretty easy to do.
I think if you're going to defend government competency, you got to go one way or the other. Either they're really competent or they're really incompetent.
Well, that's just
I could go
up,
with either
but
one
that's
of those.
Just tying up loose ends. I don't think that requires an extreme amount of intelligence. I think the average person knows that if someone out there knows something that they shouldn't know, or they can contribute to some sort of a case that you believe might be coming down and eventually put people that you know in jail, the people that are hiring you in jail, if there's some way to stop that data from being shared, that's how you cut it off. You cut it off by killing the people that were witnesses.
There are a lot of people they should have still killed then that they didn't get.
Is that true? Because they killed 100. I mean,
killed 100 people?
Yeah, let's assume that they actually did it. More than 100 witnesses were dead within a decade.
Well, you should have gotten some of those guys writing those books that sold so many copies. Just get them early.
Yeah, I mean, and by the way, just in the sense of the interest of fairness, there have been arguments against this idea.
Gerald Posner and Bugliosi both wrote good books on the other side of that.
Yeah, but not that good. Those books were not that good.
I thought they were both pretty good.
I thought they did not leave open the possibility. First of all, they did not leave open the possibility for conspiracy. And the reality is, you do not know. To call it case closed is nonsense. If you weren't there, if you didn't see it happen, if you weren't a part of it, I think you're guessing. I think you're doing a lot of guessing.
Well, but that's always the case, but if you're guessing,
you can't say case closed. You're full of shit.
Okay, you know, I see that point. Well, I can see that calling it case
the
closed.
The show, the way those books were directed, were very clearly directed in a presupposed idea that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone.
Well, they were written, and this is the thing I always try to tell people, is that don't read those books. If you don't know about the Kennedy assassination, don't, because they're not directed at you.
Mm-hmm.
They're directed at people who already know a ton about. I loved, it was one of the few books I'd ever read where they didn't footnote stuff. They said, you know, you remember this book, and they addressed other people's books without telling you about them. So you had to just, they figured you read all that stuff already. Uh-huh. They could address. Bugliosi is such a good prosecutor, though. He told me on the phone, he said it would have been a slam dunk convicting Oswald.
That doesn't mean anything.
No, it does. If you're saying, does that mean he could? Absolutely
it doesn't,
not.
See, it he's just, thinking about it as a person trying to win a game. He's not thinking about it as a person trying to find the truth. The reality of the truth is he doesn't know. I don't know. You don't know.
That's true.
The only people that know are the people that were there that played a part in that murder or didn't. Whether it's Lee Harvey Oswald and other conspirators or the other conspirators and Lee Harvey Oswald being the patsy that he claims he was. Whatever the combination of things were, whatever number was correct, those are the people that know. Right. Everyone else, there's a giant amount of guessing. And to pretend there's not a giant amount of guessing means you're an asshole. Mm-hmm. If you're pretending that you've got it nailed, right. you're an asshole.
Yep.
It's just a fact. Yep. And so the people that are arguing it online, I mean, I'll argue it online as well, but the people that actually believe that they know for a fact one way or the other, it's not true. Yep. And the magic bullet theory, there's a lot of problems with the way people describe it. A lot of the trajectory, the angles of the bodies, wasn't nearly as magical, the path they were attributing to. If you look at the fact that Kennedy was above him, that the seat was actually raised, and that Connolly was actually leaning and turning around, and the idea of their... What's much more damning is Connolly's fucking testimony himself that he was not hit first, and right. that when Kennedy was hit, he turned around, and then he heard the gunshots, and then he was hit afterwards. Mm-hmm. His own testimony refutes the idea of the magic bullet far better than anything else. When you see Connolly talk about the series of events and how it played out inside the limousine, he throws the magic bullet out the window.
Right.
The reason why they came up with the magic bullet theory in the first place, because they had a tribute, there was a bullet that hit a curbstone underneath the overpass. They had to attribute a bullet that Lee Harvey Oswald shot, or someone from that direction of Lee Harvey Oswald shot, to that bullet, because that ricocheted and hit a man, and the guy went to the hospital. So because of that, then they had to come up with one bullet doing all this damage.
Right.
But it doesn't mean it's logical.
Ballistics are weird, though, Joe. I mean, bullets do weird things.
They do weird things. And you know what they don't do?
And when you talk about witnesses in a car, remember, this is faster than the speed of sound. Mm-hmm. The sound hits at a different time. I mean, it's 100%. It's a little weird.
You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. However, if you look at the possibilities... Is it possible that a bullet hit these two bodies and smashed bone, did very little damage, actually left more fragments inside the bullet than were missing from the bullet? Is that possible? I don't know. I mean, you could have had a freak bullet that had like extra shit on it, and maybe they're attributing certain things. Maybe it's poor science, and they're attributing certain things to being pieces of the bullet that weren't actually pieces of the bullet. But the odds are that that was not a bullet that smashed bone. If you've ever seen what a bullet looks like when it hits bone, it doesn't look like that. Can it look like that? Man, I may be under some really freaky circumstance, but that's the aberration. That's not the norm. The norm is a bullet distorts wildly when it hits bone. That's part of what they're designed to do. They're designed to break up inside the body and do more damage. They're designed to hit things and spread out.
You know what Bugliosi's and Posner's book, though, did that I thought was fantastic? And it goes back to that Kim Dvorak, Michael Hastings thing we talked about a minute ago. They showed what a lot of the conspiracy writers deliberately left out of their work because it messed up their theories.
Right.
I mean, one of the big pieces of evidence that really kind of changes a lot of minds is the idea that Oswald took a shot at a general in the weeks before he shot President, or maybe allegedly shot President. And when you realize he's out there trying to kill people already, makes him look a lot less like a patsy. And a lot more like a guy who was, God, I missed the general. Hey, guess what? President Kennedy's coming in a motorcade, and I work in a building along the route. I guess I remember myself being upset with some of these conspiracy authors whose work I liked because they left this out. And I remember thinking, well, that bastard left this out. He knew that this was there, but it makes his theory look bad, and he left it out. That's where I started to get real angry at people whose work you're reading because you want to believe it and trust it.
That's a very good point, and it is certainly possible. But you know what? It's also not an either-or.
I agree with that.
Lee Harvey Oswald acted in conjunction with some other people.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of variables.
Maybe many people wanted the president dead that day.
Well, that's the real issue. Yeah. The real issue is, did the president at the time create enough enemies where there were a gang of people that wanted him dead? And that is uncontroversial.
Right.
Do you think so? Wait, now I'm even going to say it.
Incontroversial.
Well, because here's the thing that I think Oliver Stone did a great job of distorting was this idea that somehow President Kennedy had upset the military-industrial complex and all this kind of, when in reality, the guy had just done the biggest peacetime military buildup in American history. He had just remember, he campaigned on something called the missile gap.
Right.
So when he got the job, he increased military spending by a ton.
But he still wanted to get out of Vietnam.
He didn't really want to get out of Vietnam. And he was going to move assets to Laos and Cambodia. I guess my point is that he was not an enemy of those very forces that Oliver Stone had him being the enemy of.
I see what you're saying.
Yeah, he was a hawk.
But was it that black and white?
No, it was not that black and white. It was not. And you don't know what other things they may have wanted that he was pushing back on. And see, we just don't know. Like
well, you
said.
Do know that he said he wanted to get rid of the Federal Reserve.
I don't know enough about that. I can't comment intelligently on that.
I mean, I can't comment intelligently on almost everything I say, but it doesn't stop.
Some
me.
Of us stop at the membrane. Some of us are more competitive.
JFK Federal Bank.
But I mean, that's Reserve. The thing, though, that when you... What's funny about these arguments is when you see people who are really good at pushing forward all the evidence supporting their conclusion, and the stuff that doesn't fit with their conclusion, it's not there. It's like, poop, I just forgot.
They
about
do just
it.
The
it's
same just thing like, that they accuse the government of doing, right?
Exactly.
Hiding and omissions and all that stuff.
And that's why you read one book and you're like, it looks really convincing and all the points they are making looks really good. And then you're like, wait, why the hell did you leave this stuff out?
And when you find out they leave it out, you start to distrust them too.
Absolutely.
I don't trust the government or some of those conspiracy writers.
See, so the idea, the conspiracy theorist site is this executive order 11110. And this was issued by Kennedy on June 4th of 1963. And this executive order delegated to the Secretary of the Treasury the President's authority to issue silver certificates under the Thomas Amendment of the Agricultural Adjustment Act as amended by the Gold Reserve Act. And the order allowed the Secretary to issue silver certificates if any were needed during the transition period under President Kennedy's plan to eliminate silver certificates. So the idea was that he was moving in on the institution known as the Federal Reserve, because the Federal Reserve, as most people realize, isn't really a federal kind of a thing at all. It's not a part of the government. Oh, look, it's the horn again. Hopefully the police are on their way to stop this dastardly person from stealing someone's pens and change. You don't even have car radios you can steal anymore. They're all integrated into the system. Well, see, if you're not going to steal a car, and if you do steal a car, good luck trying to fucking hide it. Everybody's got a goddamn GPS in their car now, you stupid fuck. So the idea that they espouse is that this is the executive order that started the beginning of the end. I've also seen a lot of people say that they think Lyndon Johnson had something to do with having
somebody
Kennedy
just
killed.
Sent me that book. I haven't looked at it yet, but the Lyndon Johnson killed Kennedy book or something.
Is it a new one that's out?
Yeah,
I
had Jesse Ventura on my show a couple times, and
9/11.
now I get everything. All those books without even asking.
Oh, you poor bastard!
Yeah, it's bad.
I did a show with the people that did his show. And, you know, there was a couple of times where we had, like, these sort of discussions about conspiracies and, you know, what's – and I'm like, you know, they're all juicy and salacious, but the idea that if you look at too many things as being a conspiracy, you do a huge disservice to what may actually be a conspiracy.
Yeah, you're playing into the hands of the people.
Exactly.
Whether you realize it or not, I mean, to be like a crazy right-wing, radical, like the fire and brimstone sort of a guy, you play directly into the hands of the government.
Well, people slam me. I'm getting this slam like I'm an anti-conspiracy person, and they're all saying, oh, Dan Carlin, somebody even wrote a review on iTunes, said something like, he doesn't understand how the world works, and he's just giving you the pablum line. Yeah, but there are conspiracies out there, but like you said, you do yourself a disservice when you buy all of them.
Dan Carlin, you got to stop listening to critics.
I do.
You got to stop listening to those
Joe was
comments.
Telling me. Joe was telling me that before the show. He goes, to heck with them, and I don't listen to anybody.
Listen, you can learn things from people's criticism.
Feedback is good.
Yes, I've learned a lot from people's criticism, but you also have to understand human nature. And there's a lot of people out there that are sad as fuck, and they want you to feel sad too. They want you to hurt. And instead, I mean, it's
because their water is lightable on fire and flammable, and yours isn't.
It could be that. It could be that nobody wants to fuck them. I'm going with the latter. Most of the time, it's no one wants to fuck them. And you have a deficit. You have a desire for attention.
Well, I wish they'd put that in the review then.
let's
I'm probably only saying this because
I'm 496 pounds. I shit my pants on a daily basis. No one's touched me in a decade. That's
Carlin's
said,
wrong
Dan
about those
Carlin
conspiracies.
Doesn't know shit about how the world works. Fuck, he's out there confusing us. Yeah, I don't know, man. I think that you can get a lot out of it in terms of you can get other people's eyes. I think it's helped me a lot with my stand-up. It's helped me a lot. Even negative criticism, like, okay, I can see how you see that. I think it's good. It fires you up, makes you want to perform better, makes you want to, you know, analyze things with under a more critical eye, under a non-indoctrinated eye. I think it's good. But I also think you got to know when to listen to him and when not to. When someone says, Dan Carlin doesn't know how to world, you got to go, all right, dude.
Well, and I do think it shuts people down. We were talking about why more people don't get ahead and the competition thing. I think that kind of criticism does shut some people down where they're not they can't. I mean, obviously, we all can handle it because we all do something where we're criticized on a daily basis. But I mean, I think there's some people that just they don't want. It's okay if my boss does it, but I don't want it in public.
Right. I was reading a thing the other day. It's just I've been railing on about this lately about the idea of people are going on about what they're calling fat shaming. And fat shaming is making people feel bad for being overweight. And I read this one article where this woman was talking about how she was being fat shamed because she went to a family function and everyone was gushing about her cousin, how her cousin lost 20 pounds. And that they were making such a big deal out of it that it was clear to her that they were judging her for not losing the 20 pounds. So it made her feel awful. And she didn't understand how they couldn't understand that what they were doing was fat shaming her.
Get a that fucking life.
By complimenting someone on losing weight, you're fat shaming the person who hasn't lost the weight.
Wow.
And that it made her feel awful and that it was incredibly insensitive of them and that, you know, it's... I'm fascinated by that kind of thinking. I really am. I'm fascinated by that sort of like reverse victimology sort of a thing where instead of you being the victim of your own handiwork, you become like a persecuted person because they don't accept you for the flaws that you have or even mention the possibility of those flaws existing by virtue of complimenting someone for having gotten over the same flaws that you possess. Hilarious!
I think without even knowing the specifics on particular issues, anytime somebody is so willing to embrace the victim role, I smell trouble right away.
Yeah.
I'm like...
You know, there's a reality to losing weight. We have this Dave Asprey guy who's an expert in a lot of aspects of nutrition. He's a fascinating guy. And one of the things he was talking about was he was giving overweight people a pass because he was saying the level of addiction that these people actually have for food, to say that they don't have willpower is really unfair because they're so overweight. Like a lot of these folks are so far gone that they used up all of their willpower just to get up in the morning, just to walk to the bus stop, just to go to work, just to get their chores done during the day. Like they don't have the same level of energy that a healthy person has. So to attribute them to having like this like backlog of energy they're not tapping into because they're weak-willed, it's not that. Like they're already so far in the hole, it's almost impossible for them to get motivation. They have to get something like incredibly extreme has to happen to them. And I thought that was really unique in looking
at
it that
depressed
way.
Depressed people, too. Same
yes,
thing.
Yes. People out of shape, people who are depressed. You can see with people that are ruining their life, too, whether it's through addictions. Mm-hmm. You know, you see that as well. It's like, why can't they see it the way other people see it? Well, it's almost like they can't. Like, they're so trapped up in the momentum of whatever it is, whether it's gambling or food. I mean, I've seen people with food addictions that you can watch the gears spinning in their mind when food is nearby. Like, they know they're supposed to lose weight. They know they're not supposed to be eating it, but the gears start spinning in their mind, and it becomes the primary focus of their existence. Get that fucking donut. I need that donut. That donut is huge. It's critical for fueling whatever trouble is going on in their mind. And it's a weird aspect of human beings. And you don't do that any favors by pretending that encouraging someone who lost weight is a bad thing. The idea that socially that's irresponsible because you're fat and you're near them. No, it's actually responsible because that terrible feeling that you have, it's supposed to be the bump that pushes you towards eating a salad instead of a cheeseburger. Should be the bump that makes you write down everything you're going to eat that day and state some goals. This is what I'm going to do. Mm-hmm. I'm going to use my willpower to overcome this horrible obsession that I have with shitty food. That's also possible. It's also possible by you going home and blaming everybody in the blog that you've projected yourself away from any potential benefit from having these bad feelings.
Again, it's the same as about the competition. It's somebody who never learned how to lose.
And the same in avoiding criticism.
Yeah.
Like, you gotta look at it. It feels like shit, but that feel like shit, correct it so it doesn't feel like shit anymore.
I thought this show was very disorganized until you guys just tied it into a beautiful bow like that. And it's all of a sudden got a theme that's running through it. And we planned it this way, everyone.
I have a finger itch here, but
there's a way to bring this bitch around. Always.
Right. It's an art form.
It is. Oh, it most certainly is, right? I mean,
For sure, actually.
Podcasting is an art form.
It is an art form.
Look, I tell everybody, and I'll say it even though you're here. Your fucking podcast is one of my favorite things that I listen to. One of my absolute favorite things. It is a national treasure. It's so interesting. It educates people on aspects of history that were completely ignored, and it does in a really entertaining and dynamic way. And it's so important, dude.
Dude, I did not understand. Can I just tell you, I don't get it. I've never gotten it. I've never, ever gotten it.
You know what?
That's why you can do it. That's why it's good.
I mean, I'm grateful. Don't get me wrong, but I've never quite seen it as others see it.
You know? Oh, that's good. That's
you
good.
Just
that's
like Mongols. That's what I do.
You know I do, man.
It's all about the Mongols.
That's
baby.
Where you got me.
I know.
That's how you got me, because I've been a fan
He's
of
a Mongol
chaos.
Guy.
I've been a fan of chaos since I was young. It's not a fucking coincidence that I'm a stand-up comedian and I'm also a cage fighting commentator.
That's true, actually. Right,
I mean, that's not a coincidence. I'm a massive fan of chaotic events. Mm-hmm. I'm a massive fan of these explosive things that throw the norm into question and completely change the paradigm of the existing reality right. that we operate under. And when you listen to something like a podcast on the Mongols, it's like, Jesus, that was only the 1200s. Mm-hmm. That wasn't that long ago. I forgot to bring this shirt. I got this badass Genghis Khan World
Did
Tour
you?
Shirt.
That's great.
In the back, it has all the fucking towns that he sacked and all the people that were murdered.
Oh, now you got to send me a photo. I'll tweet it out.
I'll buy you one and I'll send it
yeah,
to you.
Yeah, you owe me for all these appearances I've done for you.
Son of a bitch. I do. Listen, we all owe each other, man, but I definitely owe you for many, many, many hours.
Wait, I have to stop you. I have to say, I hope this doesn't embarrass you. Did you read what that one comic said about being on Joe Rogan's podcast or having Joe Rogan endorse him? Was it Bill Burr or someone like that said, you are the Oprah of podcasting, that if we come on your show, it just all of a sudden everything is rainbows and unicorns for us once we're on Joe's show, which is true, by the way. But otherwise, I mean, the favor you've done to all the rest of us, not to kiss anybody's ass here, but it really is. I mean, you've made a lot of people aware of what we do.
Well, I'm honored that I could do that, but from my perspective, all I've done is let people know things that I found that are awesome. That's not that difficult.
The Joe Rogan Book Club.
Well, if you're honest, if you're an honest person, and I pride myself in being insanely honest to the point where, you know, I'm like one of the reasons why I'm really good at accepting criticism, because I'm insanely self-critical. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm good at avoiding going nuts.
I think
from
we
it.
All are. I think that's kind of what makes you can't do what we do without being that way.
I agree.
Yeah,
I agree. But my recognition of the role, I'm aware of it. I'm also I'm honored, and I feel like without a doubt I have an obligation. But I also feel like all I'm doing is letting people know about amazing shit that already exists. It's beautiful to be that sort of a conduit, to be sort of a funnel point where people can know they can a portal where they can go here and they can learn about all sorts of cool shit. But if the cool shit didn't exist, I would have run out of things to talk about a long time ago.
So. No, that's true. But it's also true the fact that what you have done for so many people
right.
is unreal.
Because, right.
I mean, when I think about you and Duncan, for me, in my life, the impact that it has had coming onto your show and Duncan's show in particular, it's fucking unreal, you know? So it's like, that's why I always say as a joke, but maybe not as a joke, but like, you guys ever need help moving a body somewhere? It's like, call me up
again,
in the middle of
again.
The night.
Again.
But again, you know what? I mean, it's important that you guys are out there. You guys are out there providing us with information in entertainment form that expands my view of the world. You're personally responsible for expanding my view of history above and beyond where it would have ever been without you. That's a fact. And when I looked down on iTunes and I saw your show rising through the ranks, I mean, I was so happy for you.
We were
so
the
happy.
Oprah Book Club pick of the month.
Yeah, what was the highest you got on iTunes?
Fourth.
That's insane. That's yes. all of iTunes.
And that's your help, baby.
Well, what did you? Yeah. What were you? Before?
And your listeners too, by the way.
Before you ever came on the show, what was the highest you'd ever been?
We got up to like. Eighth a long, long time ago before we had any of this competition we have now.
Oh.
It's, you know, and I don't know if folks understand that. It is so competitive now. There are so many things out there with so much promotion that to reach 20th now is a bigger deal than reaching 7th or 8th 5 or 6 years ago. I mean, it's much more competitive. But, you know, I mean, we hover around 12th, 14th, 15th, something like that.
The numbers of people making podcasts right now.
It's crazy.
Are staggering.
And yeah. But I think that's a great thing.
Absolutely.
And I've become an evangelist, and I tell people all the time, if you've ever thought about doing it, you ought to try it.
Right. Yeah, why not? Fuck
yeah,
it. You
try
never
it
know.
Out. You never know.
I mean, I would have never known if. I would have never known that.
How
that
did
would
you start,
something.
Joe? I don't mean to say to bring up a subject maybe your whole audience already knows. How did you get the idea to do this?
Well, we started just putting it on YouTube. Ustream, We got an idea.
So that was first.
Yeah, well, okay. Actually, before even Ustream, there was a thing called Justin.tv, and we were on that. We would broadcast from the green room and, like, take questions from the green room, and people enjoyed it. It was fun.
But what made you think of even – I mean, because the idea of deciding to do it is such a – especially back then, was such a weird step to take.
Well, there was a lot of people that had already done it. Adam Carolla had done it.
No, Carolla didn't do it, did he?
Yeah, he had done it before me. He had went straight from radio to doing it. That was the first episode. We had snowflakes on in the background. And we just did it on Ustream. We didn't know what we were doing. And I did it with Brian. We went from that to also Opie and Anthony. Opie and Anthony have a great radio show on Sirius. And their radio show is so similar to the way that I started doing podcasts, where it's just a hang. It's just a conversation.
Right.
I mean, sometimes I have questions for the guests. Sometimes it's kind of structured in that way where there's some things that I want to get to because I know that you have an expertise in that area. But a lot of it is just a bunch of people shooting the shit and just talking honestly about life. And I've always found that incredibly entertaining. And Anthony started doing this thing out of his basement. He set up this thing called Live from the Compound. He's a nut. He's a gun nut. He has like 50 caliber machine guns and shit. And he put a green screen behind him, and he was doing karaoke while he's singing with a gun in his hand. He's fucking crazy. But I was like, this guy's got like a professional studio set up in his basement. And I'm like, God damn it, we should start doing something. So we started doing it just on Ustream and then started putting it on iTunes. And now in the end of next month, it'll be 4 years. And, you know, we're 400-plus episodes in.
Look what iTunes has done for the whole – you know what I thought the greatest thing they ever did for people like us was not separating the ESPNs and the professional content from the stuff that we do, because it allows us an equal playing field in a way that if they said, okay, here's your professional stuff. Now here's your amateur stuff in this pile over here, in this grab bag of singles nobody wants. I feel like in the same way that we just said, you know, I mean, I owe you, I owe iTunes. There's a lot of people that made something possible here. I don't know what I'd be doing anymore without a podcast. I'm no longer a news reporter kind of guy. I'm no longer a radio talk show. I'd be like janitor, and I would be really bad at that too. So, I mean, there's a lot of people we owe for where we are today.
No
it's
doubt.
Crazy.
Yeah, and if there wasn't some sort of a form like iTunes where you could just upload it to them,
yes,
and then people could download it from the RSS
feed. And the hosting services and everything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're number six right now in the world, son.
Oh,
jeez.
You're six on iTunes.
I ought to be making more money, don't you think?
Yeah,
number six in the world.
You're getting fucked.
Do you see what I drive here? Sometimes
I wonder if this is America. I wonder if it's the U.S. But it's got some BBC stuff on there. I don't know. I don't know if it is whether or not it is actually the country or the world. But whatever it is, you're number six out of all podcasts.
Mm. And I owe your audience. And you know, your audience is awesome, by the way. I mean, I hear from them, and they always say the same thing. I found out about you from Joe Rogan.
Yep.
Just so you know,
find cool shit. Don't lie to them. That's it.
Yeah.
Find cool shit. Be honest. Be honest about how you feel about things. Mm-hmm. Don't be transparent in the way. I mean, even when I talk, like if I talk about something like the magic bullet theory or something along the, where I'll argue something, the bottom line always is I will tell you exactly what I actually do know. And I don't know. I don't know what happened. You can't know.
Right.
And I think finding out about cool things and being honest about the cool and encouraging that sort of really objective discussion about things. That's a thing that we're missing. That's a thing we're missing in our social circles. It's a thing we're missing in life. People get attached to ideologies.
Yep.
Like what you were saying, well, people will say one way or another and then just fucking argue it to death. I know Michael Hastings was killed by
the
CIA.
And then your credibility's on the line and everything. Yeah,
whether it's Bigfoot or fucking UFOs or being a Republican.
Right.
There's people that get on a fucking team and they will... And those people are a problem. They're a problem to themselves.
They're a huge problem politically, too.
Yeah.
Because as I said, you know, it doesn't hurt us that one party does something, but then when we forgive it when our party, whatever party that might be, gets in power, there are Democrats who if George W. Bush was doing what President Obama is doing, would be out in the streets with signs. But because it's their guy, they don't, and vice versa.
That's such a good point, and one that I really get on progressives and left-wing people about. I'm like, your acceptance of war crimes done under Democratic administration, the idea of the same exact things being done under the Republican administration would be horrific war crimes.
Mm-hmm.
And the acceptance of them is so gross and so telling.
And codifies the whole thing you were so against when the other guy was doing it. Because now you don't have a leg to stand on when the Republicans get back in office and do this. What are you going to say? You're going to complain about it again then?
It reinforces the idea of this being a fucking simulation, and that's all designed.
I'm liking that idea more and more.
It's the yin and yang. It's the theater. It's the two-party system.
Right.
And so it's like they brought in a fourth party, but it was too confusing. People didn't know what to follow anymore. They started tuning into different channels. As soon as that Perot character came along and fucking threw a big monkey wrench into the whole situation, It's too much. Let's go back to two and a fringy.
That's why we haven't had a third person at those presidential debates since.
Yeah, well, the Commission for Presidential Debates, yep, a privately funded institution.
Right. With half Democrats and half Republicans on their staff.
It's hilarious. And they try so hard to make sure the weirdos don't get in. Right. The Gary Johnsons of the world, the people that are going to throw.
Can I ask this, though? Why are they all weirdos? Because I keep feeling like that's almost like part of the rigged thing, that if you have somebody who has some ideas, you go, finally, somebody's saying the right thing about this, and they go, also go, yes, but I'm also a secret Klan member, just so you know. And you go, what? Why do they always have to come with some baggage like that?
That's
why?
Because you're not doing it.
That's right.
That's why. Again,
well, my Nazi newsletters from the past will all come back to haunt me, right?
That the only type of people that have the balls to step out like that are socially a little wacky. For everybody else, it's a big risk.
Didn't we talk about that? Like, if you're Anthony Weiner and you know there's more pictures out there, but you run anyway knowing they're going to catch you again and you do it anyway?
Right. Yeah, well, that guy, obviously, he's got a few fucking screws
loose. He's running for president next time. Just be ready for the publicity. He's going to turn it all around.
Yeah, I wonder what a guy like that eventually winds up doing. That is an interesting point.
He can have a podcast, of course.
He could probably be good at that.
Yeah.
He's good at talking.
Think about what you could tweet right there. That's a good promotional video. Share it with your friends.
Before they caught him the first time being a freak, there was a great video of him speaking on the floor and just like really passionate, screaming and yelling, and very eloquent, very articulate, and like, wow, this guy's like fighting for
same
the people.
Same thing, KKK letters in your past. I mean, why do you get one with the – I mean, it's crazy.
Well, I think that most people, when they get to be a certain age, they have a family, and they have obligations, mortgages, and they have certain risks they're not willing to take. And one of the big risks is you don't want to go against the entire government and say everyone's corrupt. Like, Jesus right. Christ, they'll come after you. They'll take your house. You know, your kid's got to go to college. So, like, for the guys like the Ron Pauls of the world, you know, it's like they get to be a certain age where they're just, they don't give a fuck. Like, what are you going to do? Are you going to shoot him? He's fucking 85 years old or whatever he is. You know, his last run for president is done. Now it's up to his son. And his son apparently has been using cheat sheets.
What's up with that?
Plagiarizing.
I gave the guy a lot of credit for that wonderful filibuster he did for the Fourth Amendment. Got the best publicity the Fourth Amendment's gotten in so long. And then you go pull that on me. Make me look like an idiot.
For people don't know what you're talking about.
That's okay.
Apparently he had used some words from some various speeches.
That were exactly the same.
Exactly. Is it possible that he has writers and he doesn't know?
That's what his father said the newsletters were that got his father in so much trouble. But remember, Rand Paul, who I've said nice things about, also has as one of his main advisors that guy who did the Southern Avenger, you know, one of his advisors was the Southern Avenger, and he wore a mask and had a Confederate flag behind him. And so, it's like a YouTube show or something. And then when they said, are you going to fire this guy? He goes something like, well, that's all in his past. And you just go, what's up with this? Why are these people all crazy? If you talk about freedom in our Constitution, you're crazy.
That's adorable.
Yeah.
Maybe it's the Southern Avenger. Look at his photo.
Is that him?
Oh, my God.
Come on. Wait. If that guy's on your staff and somebody you could honestly say, God, I didn't know he was a Southern Avenger. Once they tell you, don't you fire him 5 seconds later?
Yeah, I think it's probably
he didn't. So that to me right there, you go, great, thanks for taking my pet issue of the Fourth Amendment and trashing it with your Southern Avenger guy.
What is the Southern Avenger stance? Maybe I'm on his team.
I think I don't know. I have never watched the Southern Avenger.
I don't want to bet.
I saw clips.
Paint him with a broad brush.
The Confederate flag does that for you.
Yeah, it seems so sabotaged. Like, I don't know. What could he possibly
stand
for?
Well, he's confusing the shit out of me already. Conservative, libertarian, independent.
See, look what he's done. He's destroyed conservative, independent, and libertarian in one tagline. He's probably, you know, working for a group who's trying to discredit all those things.
I'm surprised he doesn't have a TM at the end of it. You know?
Well, look at the logo. It's a better logo than a lot of people have.
Yeah, I mean, what is he trying to do? Is this guy still
active?
He looks
like a wrestler, doesn't he? Yeah.
He does. Does he still have a show?
No, he works for Rand Paul now.
Still? They didn't fire him yet?
Where's Brian? He's supposed to look all that stuff
he's
up for us.
He's not going to look it up. He's just going to interrupt.
Oh, has he been banished? No, is this a temporary banishment?
No. But Rand Paul still has this guy working for him.
I can't say. I can't comment on that.
Do we know if the Southern Avenger said anything bad? He's to speak at the same conference as Rand Paul. After neoconservative alter ego was revealed, Hunter left a post on the as the Kentucky senator's social media. That's the guy? That's the Southern Avenger?
Jesus, I can see
the He looks like a guy who's a Southern Avenger. Look at that photo over his right shoulder, or the left shoulder. That's disturbing. Is that guy have no shirt on? There's like a bunch of people, and one guy has no shirt on. That's a gay orgy about to happen. a southern gay orgy. They just said, we just had some chicken. We're fixing to fuck. Look at him. The guy has no shirt on and a big chest tattoo. What if that chest tattoo was like some fucking conservative?
You don't know what's on his back.
Statement, yeah, a big Confederate flag.
That's right,
I'm sure.
I think so too.
The cover of the fucking the
but,
roof.
But,
of the
but
General
to get back
Duke.
To the point is, how come whenever you get someone who's saying some important things in a halfway, mm-hmm. you know, decent way, they have to come? You know, people say to me all the time, "Well, we vote all the time, Dan. The course the country's on is based on voters voting for people." How come when we get somebody who would like to change course in a direction most of us would like to see, half of them is really fantastic and the other half of them is so crazy you'd never elect a person like that in a million years? Why can't we have somebody who has some common sense and doesn't sound like that?
Two words, my friend. Simulation theory.
I think it all goes back. And risk management diversification.
Tool. Yeah. I wonder, you know, I think
he's hedging his bets in case white people take over the world again, you know, in a very dominant sort of way. We'll have the Southern Avenger on staff. He can advise us.
Do you ever watch those extreme preppers shows? Those shows where dudes are fixing to they're preparing for the end of the world.
Oh, the bunker people.
Stockpiling water and creating escape routes and battering rams, they're welding to the front of their pickup
trucks. They're
like
the opposite of the hoarders, because they're the hoarders that are doing it for a good cause, right?
Yeah, they believe that it's all going to come crumbling down. And those, I think that there's a mentality, and the same kind of mentality that is the type of person that wants to get in this rebellious position of power, rebellious position of, mm-hmm. you know, railing out against the government. They're very similar to these people that are prepping. It's very similar to they're extreme folks. Like, those are the only people that make it to the front of that crazy line. They have to be a bit nutty. It's not that the ideas aren't interesting to you or I when you look at a guy like Rand Paul, the things that he says that you agree with, mm-hmm. or his dad, the things that he says that you agree with, but it's to get there.
Right.
He's facing so much opposition. There's so much bullshit along the way, so much pressure, so much back and forth debate, so much frustration, so much suppression of information. Mm-hmm. By the time he gets to a position where the world is listening to him, he's already broken.
Yep.
He like broke every bone in his fucking soul just to get to the front of the line.
Yeah.
You know what's funny though? People say to me all the time, you know, can you get a staff together to do what you do so you can do better? I want more history shows. Can we help you do this? And I always say the same thing. I said, you can't help me because I can't watch y'all and I can't keep track of it. Mm-hmm. That's what all these people do. They, you know, what was it Paul said? Ron Paul said, well, this guy who wrote, he was doing my newsletter for me. I was in Congress. I didn't have time to do a newsletter. So he did it and he wrote all this stuff and I didn't know what was happening. That's my fear, is that you're going to hire a bunch of people and then you're going to turn around and go, what did you do for me? We started the Southern Avengers show for you. We thought it'd be a good promotional vehicle for your show, Dan.
No doubt. Yeah, you know? No doubt. I think that there's...
It's a catch-22. Do you give away some of your control, or do you keep it, you know, where you know everything's cool? But the minute you give it away, you got rogue people, you know, with your name running around graffitiing the side. Banksy and Carlin were here.
Somebody isolated the photograph. This is the photograph. It's all a bunch of wrestlers.
The Southern Avenger looked like a wrestler.
Yeah, these are like old-school Southern wrestlers. That I was probably right. They probably butt-fucked each other as soon as this was over. And this guy's got this in he's got it framed on his wall in the background of his fucking study. So, yay, Southern Avenger. Yay, simulation theory.
Wait, does it say he parted ways? So there, so he got rid of him finally. I guess the hue and cry was a little too much for a sitting senator from Kentucky to have somebody named the Southern Avenger on his staff.
Well, he was a co-author of the 2011 book with Rand Paul, The Tea Party Goes to Washington.
Oh, God. I've maybe forgotten that. I blanked it out.
But you're right. It is funny that these people, they have to be
wacky. Can't have a Fourth Amendment person who's not wacky. I mean, I guess you do. You got guys like Wyden and Udall and some of these people, mm-hmm. but when you get somebody who's a real lightning rod for this stuff, and you think, finally, we've been waiting for a guy like this forever, they come with these poison pills that you just can't swallow.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate reality of the control that has been exerted on the political climate. I mean, the fact that the two-party system exists just shows you how much power the people that are in power, you know, the people that are mm-hmm. running things, how much they've actually been able to exert on our system. They've locked it down to two parties that are both often supported by the exact same corporations.
George Carlin said, you know exactly how many people you have to bribe.
Yeah, well, Bill Hicks had the best bit. He's like, he goes, well, I like the puppet on the left. He's more to my liking. Well, the puppet on the right supports my beliefs. Hey, wait a minute. There's one guy holding both puppets. I mean, that's really, that was like his description of America. That's a really good one.
How come we don't get it then, Joe? This is what I don't understand, is that if we're going to work toward this awareness, and if we're going to get better and more involved and enlightened, mm-hmm. how do we not see through that scam? That would be like first scam you have to see through to get to anywhere, and we don't see through that one.
Well, smart people that are on the Democratic side are partially to blame, just as much as people on the conservative side. But on the Democratic side, I've heard so many people use the term "we," like we need to get into office, or we need to get more of this, or we, you know, we control right. the House. I'm like, we, like Hollywood people. I have had maddening conversations with people in Hollywood that use the term "we" to describe the Democratic Party.
Right.
And I'm like, they're not you, dude. They're not you by a long stretch. And you perpetrating this stupidity. I understand that you work 12 hours a day sure. and you don't have the time to investigate this thoroughly, but you pretending to be a smart guy and going with this team, we need to do that. And we need, like, how much of what they're doing are you really fucking paying attention to? Because right. this Democratic Party that's in charge right now is as Republican as it gets when it comes to whistleblowers, as Republican as it gets when it comes to giving rights to corporations mm-hmm. that are the same rights that used to be attributed to individuals.
Yep.
The all the things that we were afraid of during the Bush administration are all being done to a much the attacks on whistleblowers to a much larger degree, the attacks on secrecy and privacy, much larger than has ever been exhibited before. Those are all Republican ideas. So when do they become Democratic ideas?
I had a famous political reporter here in L.A. when I was learning about news explain it to me this way. She goes, I'm going to give you the secret to what the difference between the two parties are. And she kept it from me, and she kept it from me. And then one day when we were going to interview Dan Quayle, of all people, believe it or not, when he was the vice president, she says, okay, the time has come to let you in on the big secret between the two parties. So I, you know, lean forward. I say, what is it? She goes, at the Republican fundraisers, you get your wine in a glass. At the Democratic fundraisers, it comes in a plastic cup. That was it. That was this big piece of knowledge I was waiting for. The difference between the two parties is what they serve the wine in when you go to their get-togethers.
They're so deeply entrenched in money. And when I'm saying that those are Democratic ideas or those are Republican ideas, I don't mean it as in they are actually Republican ideas. I mean it as in the people that are on the Democratic side that believe in equality and freedom and left-wing values, they think that those ideas are only things that the Republicans support. So when they're clearly being supported by the Democratic Party, who's who? What's going
right,
on? Is
right.
up down? Is down up? Is everybody getting paid here? Like, what exactly is going on?
I think we assume these people have ideas when really they're taking money. 20% of them do, but I think 80% of them have the ideas you pay them to have.
And also, it's a giant group of people. In order to play politics,
right.
you have to appease certain groups, and you have to be very good socially at this sort of give and take system that they've put into place, the cronyism
right.
system. I mean, when you look at that all these people that are lobbyists live in Virginia, that's right outside of D.C., and they come in, and there's all this money concentrated on making things happen there, it's totally against the concept of we the people. It's totally against the concept of the interests of the individual, the interests of the greater good of the society as a whole. It's totally against that. It's against it, and it's transparent, and it's right,
right
in everybody's face.
But I think a lot of people do get it. Like, I don't think it's an issue of lacking awareness, at least now, you know. If you talk 30 years ago, you had maybe a different story. But post-Nixon, ever since, you know, confidence in government has been collapsing sharply, confidence in the political system, you know, everybody to some degree or another hates it, feel like, it's corrupt. I think there is a level of awareness of that. What there isn't is the, okay, then what do we do about it? You know, that part is the, we have the knowledge that this thing sucks, but what can I or my neighbor or the next guy do to change this? What steps could be taken? And that's when people go,
don't you think more people know it sucks now than ever before?
Yeah.
And more people know why it sucks now.
Well, yeah. And you know what the real, and this ties something else up in a bow we talked about earlier with the fracking and the environmental damage and everything else. Part of the problem we have, too, is we have a system here in the United States that is designed to be moderate and not radical, mm-hmm. which sounds fine most of the time. But if you put off problems long enough, the solutions that are moderate to fix them are no longer
yeah.
useful. I mean, if your
yeah.
house is slipping on its foundation and you get to it early, maybe a little bit of money and a little bit of work and you can fix that. If you put that off 10, 15 years, the solution to that problem is a lot more radical. We have put off a lot of huge problems in this country and solving them for so long that the solutions are so radical that we have a system that is just geared to tampen down that sort of radicalism.
Yeah.
But what does that mean if that's what it takes to fix some of the problems?
That's a very interesting point. And then there's the idea that we're going to come up with some way in the future to clean up all the mess that we've created in
the past. Fix it later. Something will be invented.
Technology will take care
of
it.
All we need to do is get our backs against the wall, because that's when America's at its best.
That's right.
We got our back against the wall. Right. Tell you what, we come out swinging.
The better mousetrap will emerge. Don't
worry. We come out swinging. We're going to make some GMO fish that eat plastic and send them bitches out there, and then we got all our problems solved. We're going to have the greatest population of fish in the history of the fucking ocean, because we're going to have plastic-eating fish that we've made in the lab. They got a steel lining to their stomach, and they run on fossil fuels.
Forced consciousness expansion. Maybe they will prompt the awareness by putting the hallucinogenics in the water, and there you go.
Well, a lot of people believe that they came in asteroids, Dan Carlin. They came from other planets.
It's a simulation. There are no other planets.
There's a chemical. The chemical composition of mushrooms, the 4-phosphoryloxy-N,N-dimethyltryptamine, or however you say it.
Wow.
The things being in the phosphorus in the 4 positions, the only group of them in the entire world. So there's no immediate ancestors to psilocybin.
You are talking way over my head.
I'm talking over my head, too.
Way over my head.
Repeating some shit that I heard Terrence McKenna say.
Oh.
But the idea is,
as long as we're clear on that, right?
Spores can survive in a vacuum. The idea of panspermia is a well-accepted idea in astronomy, and that idea is that life, the building blocks from life, water even, came from other planets. Asteroid impacts on other planets sent large bodies into space. They landed on Earth, many of them perhaps, you know, billions and billions and billions of years ago, and actually created the oceans, actually created a lot of life itself, the building blocks for life. So in a sense, we are all of alien composition, period. But other things are continuing to come this way, including spores, which can survive in a vacuum. Mm. And when you have large doses of psilocybin mushrooms, one of the weird things is you feel like you're communicating with something. You feel like you're – and the whimsical amongst us believe that what you're actually doing is communicating with an alien life form that has come here and wants you to eat it in order to tune into it.
You know, I actually have some thoughts that I agree with some of that, and this is coming from someone who doesn't talk about this very much, but I've always been fascinated with how things like that have been used by humankind throughout history as a means to open up other, you know, to use Huxley's term, doors of perception. It's fascinating to me when you think – if you think that none of this stuff is – you know, if you think about evolutionary things, right? So this is all stuff that evolves. Why the hell were hallucinogenic mushrooms – what's the evolutionary benefit to the mushroom itself to have that? Is it supposed to ward off birds from eating it because they get a bad trip if they do?
Right.
I find it fascinating how much of a role – you know, we did a podcast once about the hidden side of intoxication in history. Well, I think you could make a very good case that hallucinogenics of all kinds have probably played huge roles in history that we don't even know about, especially with tribal peoples who have played huge roles. I mean, why did the Germans decide to migrate into Roman territory at just this time? Well, they have sorcerers and witch doctors as part of their culture who use hallucinogenics. Who knows that they didn't go to the chieftain there and say, you remember that thing I told you we have to do? I was just told now is the right time. Move into that Roman territory and all history is different. I mean, that's the side of history we're never going to get. Be interesting to find out how much of history has been determined by things like that.
That episode, by the way, was hilarious. I remember.
Oh, you like that one?
It was awesome.
Well, you can't, the problem is that you can't know. So the whole thing is speculative. But you can say, well, Napoleon had opium the night before Waterloo and he slept late and he was sluggish. How much did that impact history? And so you got to go.
Sense.
You got to use the little teeny pieces of the jigsaw puzzle you know about to construct a totally fictional narrative that might be true.
Well, there's one thing that's undeniable. People love altering their consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, and that's
it.
True.
They love it so much that in this day and age, we have Partnership for a Drug-Free America, mm-hmm. and they're
who are
funded,
bucking against the trend, right?
Who not only that are funded initially by alcohol and tobacco companies, now mostly by pharmaceutical companies,
of course,
which is so rich and so delicious. The way I described it, I go that having pharmaceutical companies and allowing them to do literally commercials against marijuana is like hookers making commercials against strippers.
Right.
Like, wow. It's like the most ridiculous things.
It is.
The idea behind it is, you know, it's so preposterous. Mm-hmm. But we still have a method And as long as you give people a method, they'll accept a certain amount of restrictions. As long as the method is good, and the method is very good. The alcohol method is great.
Well, think about if prohibition hadn't been repealed. I mean, think about how interesting a world we might live in today had that stayed the law of the land.
I don't think it can. I don't think you can have no options for people to... Well, the one thing that's interesting is during prohibition, marijuana was legal. Marijuana wasn't legal until after prohibition.
Henry Anslinger and all those people.
Anslinger and William Randolph Hearst. They actually originally did it to try to suppress hemp as a commodity.
Right, because you got so much more paper out of hemp than you got out of trees, and if you're in the business of making paper and you're in the business of the logging industry.
I mean, that's also a perfect example of the difference between controlling information back then and today.
Right.
If they were able to sell this idea that there's a new drug that was forcing Mexicans and blacks to rape white women, and they even named this drug marijuana, which is a name for a Mexican slang term for a wild tobacco. Had nothing to do with cannabis.
You know what does blow me away, though? What blows me away, I can understand you making the case that this has to be illegal, whatever we're talking. This has to be illegal because it's so dangerous and we know it's so dangerous. What I don't understand is that we basically have a policy in this country that there will be no new intoxicants.
Yes,
if something is invented in a bathtub tomorrow that doesn't hurt anybody, that has no hangovers, that nobody gets in car, we're going to ban it the day after tomorrow on general principles. That's what I don't understand.
Not only that, there are beneficial drugs that they have to attribute to diseases in order to get them passed through. Yep. Like there's a thing called Provigil, and Provigil is this smart drug that all of these Silicon Valley entrepreneurs
are on. You know a lot about this stuff, Joe. I'm impressed.
Day. Some impressive stuff.
Yeah.
Provigil's pretty wild. Mm-hmm. And it gives you this buzz, but it doesn't give you a caffeine-y buzz. It's not like a heart rate thing. It gives you this clarity thing. It's a very strange sort of intoxicant, or a sort of a pharmaceutical drug, rather. But they couldn't just sell it as a performance-enhancing drug.
Mm-hmm.
So they had to sell it as some sort of a response to a disease. So they came up with narcolepsy. It's like, narcolepsy.
Okay, I've heard about this.
But it was originally created in order to, like, it was created to benefit consciousness. But you can't do that. You can't have a drug that just a drug that makes you smarter. You literally can't. There has to be something wrong with your fucking brain. So they have to come up with something.
Right.
That's a weird rut.
Well, but here's the weird thing. If that's how it has to be, why don't they all go back and then find things? You know, couldn't you sell the old drugs that way? Yeah, I guess they are, kind of. I mean, if you think about it, that's what the whole medical marijuana kind of thing could be construed as if you wanted to. Well, we found a new way to market this thing. It's a solution to a problem.
Yeah, well, medical marijuana is the reason why that's the back door that gets it in.
Yeah, I think we all understand that. Yeah. Even if we think that there are, and I do think there are medical uses for this stuff, there's no question that it has been used as a back door to sort of open the door to what would not have been possible without it.
Also, ingeniously getting people...
I'm just throwing it out there.
Getting people in government and addicted to the money and the revenue that it brings legally,
that's true.
Which you don't get at all if it's illegal. The money still goes into the economy, and that's been really documented in British Columbia, that the economy is very dependent even though it's illegal.
Mm-hmm.
But the taxes that you would get from selling it, the government actually is what loses out on marijuana being illegal. The government loses out because they're not getting any of the tax money from it being sold.
Right. It's still really one of the things we create and do well in this country, too. You'd think they'd be hard sort of safeguarding the few things we do well in producing in this country.
Well, they're just starting to now pass laws. You know, at Onnit, we sell hemp protein powder, but we have to buy our hemp protein powder in Canada. It's legal to possess. It's legal to sell. It's not legal to grow. That is so asinine because you're not even talking about a psychoactive plant. You're talking about the male version of the cannabis plant.
It's rope.
The different variations, the cousins of the cannabis plant. There's more than one different type of hemp, but all of them, what they all have share in common is the amount of THC in them is insanely small.
Yeah.
So what you're getting out of it is just a textile. You're getting clothes, you're getting oil, you're getting food that you can eat, and we can't even grow it in America. We're buying it in bulk from Canada, and then we sell it. We try to buy the best stuff that we could possibly find, and it's really difficult. Like, because unless you can grow it yourself, like, it's hard to quality control. You have to like really search out these farms that are in another country that are growing this shit. And it's so stupid. So they're just starting to pass passed laws that are allowing farmers to grow it in America. California has recently passed it. They're trying to pass it in other states. I believe they passed it in Colorado, and I believe they passed it in Washington State, because those are the two places where they've made it legal to consume for adults.
I saw one of the best documentaries I've seen on this. There's this documentary called Standing Silent Nation, which is what happened a few years ago on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota.
For those who are Italian accent impaired, he said, Standing Silent Nature.
Nation.
See?
Yeah, I understood him. I don't know what you're talking about.
Standing Silent Nation.
That was really cool. It showed what happened on Pine Ridge, which was, you know, one of the poorest reservations in the United States, where prospects for economic growth are really dim. And so what these guys did, they figure, you know, we are somewhat of a sovereign entity, because that's how reservations are, right? They are in this weird limbo. And they figure, okay, we can plant industrial hemp. We'll cultivate it. We'll do this whole thing. And you see the progression through the documentary of the viciousness with which the DEA goes after them to just stamp it out. And you see the facts that you are listing right now, you know, the THC aspect, the fact that this is not a drug. You know, we're not talking about a drug. You're not talking about marijuana as, you know, even marijuana is ridiculous, but that's a whole different story. There are none of the THC that you find in the, it's the same plant, but yeah. It's like marijuana without the stuff that gets you high. And you use it for a million things that, as you say, it's legal to own the products in the United States, but it's not legal to grow it where we can actually make the product in the United States.
And there's no argument for it.
It just makes no sense.
It's a commodity. It's a commodity that's being banned because of a close association with an intoxicant. Yep. An intoxicant, by the way, it's the safest known to man.
Exactly.
One that has massive amounts of medical benefits, documented for sure, for real, non-controversial medical benefits. And it's illegal.
I've never understood why we don't have, you know, because I always thought one of the arguments that screwed up kids the most was to put marijuana on this list of terrible drugs, because then when they try the marijuana, they think you're lying about the heroin.
Right.
I always thought that there ought to be a checklist that the government used to decide if something should be legal or illegal. You know, 100 questions. How addictive is it likely to be? You know, how dangerous? How many? Blah, blah, blah. And then if you pass or fail, you know, if you pass, it's legal. If you fail, that also would be used if you invent some new bathtub drug tomorrow. Okay, well, let's run it down the checklist, right? And then you could say to the people, well, look, I mean, here's how it scored on the checklist. And I think the damage to that would be because alcohol might not score very highly on
that's
that.
Exactly.
But certainly I don't think that there's any way marijuana doesn't score better than most of the intoxicants that are out there today.
Right.
And I think, I guess what I'm saying is, I think it would help me in raising my own children and keeping them off these harder drugs to be able to have a decent argument. There's a good reason this heroin isn't in general use, kids. Yeah. It'll really hurt you. Trust me. It wouldn't be illegal if it wouldn't really hurt you.
Well, what's mind-boggling is that that's not even Schedule 1.
Heroin, I know, because medical uses. Schedule. That's right.
Heroin is scheduled Schedule 2. Schedule 1, the most dangerous of all drugs, marijuana is in that.
I remember
that's an insult.
Ronald Reagan in the 80s, marijuana is the most dangerous drug in America.
Yeah. Oh, that was a great speech.
How the fuck can you even say that?
Pull
that
speech up. It's hilarious. You know, they found that cone snail venom, they can make a drug out of cone snail venom that is 100 times more potent than any existing pain medication, and it's completely non-addictive. So it works 100 times better than all of the OxyContins and all that other shit, and it's not addictive. Wow. Listen to this.
Because the message this evening is not my message, but ours. Despite our best efforts, shortages of marijuana are now being reported. From the early days
this
of
is
not our
great. This is a parody.
Yeah,
it's a parody.
Fail. Failed hard, dude.
That's what I have to say to my mythical producer all the time. Yeah, fail.
How dare you? It becomes an insult, and it becomes one more piece of evidence that we're getting fucked. Mm-hmm. And it's bad to have that out there if you want to run a government,
right?
Because it fuels the resistance. It fuels people's...
It turns the citizens into the enemy.
Yes.
That's what it does.
Yeah, there's millions and millions of fucking Schedule 1 criminals in this country.
It turns the buttocks-clenching guy who run the stop sign at Walmart into the bad guy. Well, he didn't even have any marijuana on him. That's the part I like. But marijuana was the... Do you know that that's what they suspected him of having?
Yeah.
So here's the thing. So I'm in my car, and I've got some marijuana I want to smoke later, but I'm afraid if it's in my car, you'll find it. So I shove it up my rear end so that I can smoke it later. The whole thing is so insane.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
We're living beautiful. In a simulation,
it's
right?
It's not real. Wiener, he's not real. Wiener showing his wiener. Come on, none of it's real. It's not real. We're all mad. We're mad as a hatter. And we're just alone by ourselves somewhere, linked up to some computer, trying to pretend that this fucking simulated society we've pieced together makes
any sense.
I'd
be very
sense.
Interested to hear what they're writing on Rogan's message board about this wide variety of interesting topics.
No, what do you mean? It's all scripted, right?
That's true. I'll get right back to it. Let me see what
read
it says
it,
here.
Savages. Well, we're a New World Order mouthpiece here at the Joe Rogan Experience podcast. I don't know if you know that. I became a New World Order mouthpiece once I started doing that Joe Rogan Questions Everything.
Oh, of
and
course.
I wasn't really willing to question everything.
Oh. I thought the eye rolls that you did were absolutely artistic in some of those
Thank
scenes.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Well, it got to a certain point where I was like, you know what? I can't do this anymore. I can't keep talking to liars, you know, and pretending that we're putting together a TV show. When I was talking to a guy who told me he saw a bulletproof wolf that popped out of a vortex of mist.
Wow. Somebody told you that?
Yeah, it's true. By the way, he also told me he saw a UFO, sees him on a regular basis, and went and found Bigfoot the very first time he went looking for it. I was like, oh, criminy. Like, what am I doing with my life? This is, like, we're so far off of the reality road that I'm never going to find my way back.
It is hard to maintain the straight-faced thing.
It's not worth it. At a certain point in time, you're like, oh, this is just a broken idea. This is a person with they're chasing down thoughts that are bad, and they don't stop chasing them down. And they're reasonably intelligent, so they can argue their way around these things when confronted. And Michael Shermer had a quote about that, about really smart people who believe in really dumb things because they're smart enough to argue it. And I think that's the case with a lot of these folks. Mm-hmm. And the flaw in the thinking is so obvious. So when I didn't believe in chemtrails, that every fucking airplane that you see a contrail that's persistent is the government spraying us with evil chemicals, all of a sudden people were like, you're a fucking mouthpiece for the New World
Order. I told you, I got that too, though, for questioning the Hastings thing. And yeah.
But you know, well, that's you're going to get that.
That's the problem when you have a worldview that's nuanced, when you have
nuanced.
Something
wonderful
that's...
Word. Wonderful word, yes.
Thank you, by the way, for putting it in a way that now the public understands.
No, no,
when
no.
I first said
Everybody
it, you
got
it.
It
so.
Everybody got it.
Yeah. But yeah, because the fact is, like, the reviews you get or the feedback that Joe is getting about this stuff, to me, is not surprising, because anytime you have a position that's not stereotypical, where you're not clearly in one camp 150%, where is the Oswald did it, or no, that's total bullshit, how can you believe that? Or, you know, about anything, right? When you start asking questions that poke holes in one line of thinking, but then at the same time, when people start feeling reassured that, oh, then you are on this side, then you start saying, well, kind of, but wait a second, because also there's something here that's problematic here. And you're just keeping an open mind, right? It doesn't mean that you can't commit to an idea. It doesn't mean that you are flip-flopping. You're just considering the pros and cons, and sometimes it's not that black and white. It drives people crazy.
Well, and the media doesn't want you to do that either, because they used to tell me on the radio, a listener has to know where you stand on every issue within 3 minutes of turning you on. And I said, that's a cartoon character. Yeah, that's not a real person. And it's the same thing where I had just done a show recently where we were talking about go ahead, just wrap this up.
The point is that
whole idea that nuance is a bad thing. Somebody called me. I'm being called a moderate and a realist more and more today, which is coming from like tinfoil hat, crazy radical territory. And I haven't changed my views at all in 20 years. Well, a couple things, but basically, it means that society, like you said, has started to pick up on things and has moved in a direction. I used to say to people, the NSA is spying on everyone, and they said, "No, they're not. You're crazy. Get your tinfoil hat out." Now I say, the NSA is spying on everyone, and they go, "I know."
Yeah.
You know, so society has just sort of moved in a different direction, and nuance, that's what society's missing today, gray areas.
Yeah, I've been called a conspiracy theorist with good reason for a long time about a lot of different subjects, but I've always found it really odd that the idea that people haven't conspired on things is so attractive to people.
Right.
Like, people want to be able to debunk things just as willingly as other people want to find conspiracy in things. And there's some things that are not debunkable. Mm-hmm. There's some realities.
Debunkable.
Yeah,
I
there's
like
some
that.
Realities, like the reality of the fucking central bank, the reality of the realities of the influence of the Bilderberg group, the realities of the influence of corporations and special interest groups and lobbyists. Those are real.
Yep.
Those are real things. So if those exist, those are probably some of the biggest conspiracies the entire world has ever known.
Right.
And they're right in front of your fat fucking face.
Yeah.
Okay, look at the reality of money today and what money's controlling whether or not this Gasland documentary is 100% correct, even if it's 50% correct, that 50% is fucking terrifying.
Right.
And every one of those examples that they showed, that if those were the only examples, and I don't think they are, we're doing something crazy, and it's all being done because of money. Right. We're ruining this world forever, whether it's the ocean patch that's bigger than Texas, that's all plastic, that's floating out there and choking birds and whales. And a whale was just – a beached whale just died. His stomach was filled with plastic. I mean, we what we are doing for real that we're doing bad is fucking insane.
Yep.
So anybody who's not willing to look at the other possibilities, like – man, your rigid view of the world is fucking your head up. There's some weirdness afoot.
Yep.
Simulation theory, goddammit, I'm telling you.
Short-term gain, baby. That whale wasn't doing any good for me.
Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone. Case closed, I say.
Done.
Case closed. Well, listen, I think we could do this at the end of time, the end of today, but we're not going to. This is it. We're going to wrap this up. But we could fucking do this again. God damn it. Dan Carlin, Daniel Bolelli. Thank you for coming up with this idea. This is Mr. Bolelli's idea.
I came up with it without telling either of you.
I felt both of you. There was a mind meld. And if anybody wants to listen to Daniele Bolelli's podcast, it is The Drunken Taoist. It's available on everything, right? Yep. iTunes. Yep. And is it on Stitcher as well?
Yeah, Stitcher.
And, of course, Dan Carlin is not one, but two fucking podcasts. Jesus Christ, as if you had enough free time to absorb them all. One is Hardcore History, which is absolutely sensational. The other one is DC Common Sense. A little mediocre. No, I'm just kidding. Lies. They're both awesome. Lies. And you can catch them on iTunes. He gives away the first 50 for free just to get you hooked. And then the rest of them you get by prescription. Prescription? I should say prescription because you can learn. It's good for your brain. Subscription. But they are fucking worth it. They're goddamn books. They're audio books. They're lessons on life and the history of this wacky-ass country.
Thanks, Oprah. So
get them, bitches. Go get them. Go after it. And I want to thank our sponsors for sponsoring this podcast, specifically Carbonite. Carbonite, the awesome backup program. Use the code word JRE for a free trial. No credit card required. Thanks also to Stamps.com. Use the promo code JRE and get a $110 bonus offer. Thanks also to onnit.com. That's O-N-N-I-T. Use the code name Rogan. Save 10% off any and all supplements. All right, we love the fuck out of you guys. We have a great week next week, including I got an astronaut coming in, fuckers. I got that guy, Commander. What is it? Hold on, Commander. He was the dude who, let me find this this email before we wrap this up. Because I have to be... hold on a second. Oh, boy, isn't this a fucking great way to end an awesome podcast? Let me searching through my fucking email like a moron. Colonel Chris Hadfield. Chris Hadfield was... he was up in the space station until recently. The Canadian astronaut that was in the news. He'll be here on Monday. We also have... next week, we have Graham Hancock is coming in. On Wednesday should be fantastic, and Anna Kasparian from the Young Turks, she will be here on Tuesday. So it's a fun-filled week, you freaks. And I will see you guys Saturday night in Edmonton at the River Cree Casino with the lovely and talented Sam Tripoli. And thank you. Thank you to Dan Carlin. Thank you to Daniele Bolelli. It was a beautiful time had by all, and we love the fuck out of you people. See you soon.